runaway train, just to feel alive again. Pushing forward through the night, aching just to blur aside.
Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. The biggest video game of the year, likely in sales, if nothing else, Red Dead Redemption 2 came out, and we have played a good amount of it. I've been playing it more or less nonstop since Friday. What about you, Sean?
Yes, I played it pretty much nonstop yesterday on Saturday. Friday, I didn't get it in until very late, and then today I have had not had a huge amount of time to play it, but I probably put like a solid 8 to 10 hours on just on Saturday playing it, so yeah.
I would guess that too. I just got to chapter 3 as a reference.
Okay. I'm not quite there yet. I'm in the heart of chapter 2. I've not spent a lot of time doing story missions.
Okay.
I've been doing a lot of random shit.
Yeah.
So
to spoil a little bit of my review later, I have found the story in Red Dead Redemption 2 unbelievably compelling for a Rockstar game, so I've been playing a lot of it. So that's my little positive thing I'll say there. We have lots of positive things to say. This is a really interesting game. We will give first impressions. No spoilers, because we don't really have any big spoilers to give, you know?
Yeah.
Even if I told you everything that had happened so far, I don't think it would count as a spoiler, because I'm like 20% through, you know? Mm-hmm. So we will talk about Red Dead Redemption 2 at length, give you our thoughts on that. We will also, in the spoiler section of this episode later on, talk about this week's Doctor Who, the something or other spiders and arachnids in the... It doesn't matter. It's forgettable. It's a Chris Chibnall episode of Doctor Who. I don't know how long we can even keep these fucking Doctor Who segments going if the show is at this quality. So that's my current frustration.
Yes. I at least... You can remember the title of the episode because it's a parody of the song Anarchy in the UK, because the title is Arachnids in the UK.
That is the most clever thing about that episode.
Yeah. It is not really much of a parody, because while Arachnids looks a lot like anarchy when it's written, it doesn't sound anything like the word anarchy, so I don't think it really works for me as a pun. But
I had not even thought of it, because you're correct. The pun is not obvious if you just verbalize it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Red Dead. That'll be an episode. We have one piece of news. Sean, what have you been up to? Do you have any stuff for us?
Yeah, I got a good little pile of stuff here. One, I finished Dragon Quest XI. That's a good game. We will do a podcast
game
on that. So I don't know if there's... I will say, like, I didn't love a lot of the post-game stuff necessarily. That was not my favorite part of the game. I think there's interesting bits of story there and bits of story that, like, I kind of wish that there was a little bit more. I can't really talk about it without spoiling it, because the whole nature of what the post-game thing is a massive spoiler. But yeah, I thought it's a really interesting thing they do in how they like set up the post game content, but I found it a little bit lacking for me personally.
Interesting. I really liked it. I was skeptical at first, and I came around to it, and I found the ending very moving and proper, and I'm curious to see how we talk about that when we get there.
Yeah. So that'll be a much bigger discussion on that podcast. But the other things I want to talk about are, I have finished The Haunting of Hill House since last time, which I need to try to do, be very good about not calling it House on Haunted Hill, which is a different thing than The Haunting of Hill House, and it's so fucking confusing because they're both horror classics. But yeah, that's the Netflix series I talked about last week, where I think I was at episode 4 out of 10 episodes, and I've now finished it. And I like it a lot. It loses a little bit of traction right at the very end, which luckily I was just kind of prepared for that, because it's a long-form horror story, and long-form horror stories always lose traction at the end when they have to kind of really settle down and provide resolution, because resolution is so, like, you know, antithetical to the horror genre. But it runs into, like, a, like, normal gamut of sort of traps and pitfalls that the genre always runs into when it gets into that kind of resolution mode. But up until that point, I think the series is just really fantastic. Episode 9 is really, really good. And, like, that was where I was, like, I was not expecting the first nine-tenths of it to be really good, and I was expecting more like probably around episode 8 would be the drop-off when it was getting into resolution mode, but it's only that those issues only really affect the last episode, episode 10. And up till then, I think it is just a really phenomenal little like sort of like horror mini series that feels incredibly self-contained. Like, I don't know if they've talked anything about this team doing another series like this, but there's certainly no, there's no Haunting of Hill House season two, you know. It is definitely, it is like these 10 episodes, it tells the story of this family and their relationship with this like haunted house.
Is it,
and that's it.
Is it definitely done? Because Netflix has done a lot of series like that where everyone's assuming there's no way you could, that was a very self-contained thing, and then they force a season two.
I mean, there are, I don't consider this a spoiler, that there are enough characters still alive at the end that they could do more. Like, it's not like every character's dead and it would be literally impossible to, well, even if then you could, it's a fucking ghost thing. So there's, you could
okay, they will be forcing a season two. I will, we'll just table okay. this prediction. I am 99% sure they will force a season two.
Like, I think there's a, like, I think there's a possibility that you take this same basic team of people and maybe, like, one or two of the characters and do, like a totally different story with it and a different haunting and different scenarios. But there's no, I do not think that this writing team would even, like, really want to do anything more with these characters, because the whole point of The Haunting of Hill House, the series, is, you know, is that it is one part horror show and is one part family drama. And so much of the series is about each of the, particularly the five siblings, who are basically the main characters, who are kids and that living in the house when it was originally haunted, and then now are kind of like all brought together by circumstances from the first episode of the series. And so the whole series is built around their specific kind of personality quirks and their neuroses and their different kind of paranoias and stuff related to the haunting. And all of, and that's like where episode 10 kind of gets a little bit like tedious, is that all those things kind of have to get resolved, and it's not as interesting as when everything's incredibly messy throughout the rest of the series. But so there's like, I don't see how you could do a much more story with almost any of these characters, because their storyline is done. There is definitely no like hanging thing at the end that's like, oh, if you made another thing, you would follow this thread. There's nothing like that. There's no hint of it at all. So I feel like, you know, whether or not they try to shit out some weird season two, you could easily ignore it, because yeah. nothing about this series in any way sort of sets up or expects there to be a continuation. And it's one of the things that feels like, even though from what I understand, this series is like not very strictly based on the novel, it takes some ideas from the original Haunting of Hill House novel, the series itself has a very novel-like structure. In the way that some more kind of like modern young adult novels like to do this, like really like big meaty chapters with each chapter told from one character's point of view. That's kind of been a trend for about 10 years or so. And it's got that kind of flavor to it. And for the first 6 or 7 episodes, and even like a little bit later, because like, episode 9 kind of does this also in a cool way, each episode is mostly told from one character's POV. It'll break, not in a strict sense, it'll break it when it needs to, but generally speaking, each episode is really focused on one character, and you can see it in, I can see in my mind's eye, as like if you're reading a book, this is like, oh, this is the chapter called Shirley, that is about Shirley, and it goes through her past, and then like catches us up with the present, and then pushes the main story forward a little bit at the end of the chapter, and like segues into the next character. That's sort of the structure, and I think that just works so fantastically for balancing out the horror stuff, because the horror aspect of the series stays fresh for all, you know, the 9 episodes that the series feels fresh, and that kind of balancing of the different characters' personality types and their own relationship to the supernatural and the ghosts of the house makes the series feel really alive, again, way past the point than I thought it was. I was so prepared going into this, being like, episode 6 or 7 is where it's going to kind of turn, and it is not like that at all. It is only at the very end that I feel like it kind of disappoints a little bit, and even then, it's not bad. It's not like, what's that one movie where Patrick Wilson goes into the ghost dimension?
The Conjuring? And starts...
No, Insidious. It's the other one of those. I haven't seen Conjuring yet, but Insidious is a really good haunted house movie for 30 minutes, and then it's a really meandering movie for the next like 30 minutes, and then the last 30 minutes are Patrick Wilson in the ghost dimension punching ghosts in the face, and by the time you get to there, it's like all concept of this being an interesting or compelling horror story has gone. It doesn't do that. There's no ghost punching. At least all the story resolution stuff feels really focused on the characters, and if anything, it could have just been like edited down a little bit more, because it's about an hour-long episode that could have been like 50 minutes. But other than that, I think it is, if you are interested in a nice little Halloween treat, you could like binge this series really nicely, and it works really well. And I like it a lot. It is, I think, probably my favorite of all the Netflix TV shows. I've watched. It hangs together better than any of the others.
Interesting. Okay, cool. It's an hour long, right?
Each episode is about an hour long.
Okay, yeah. Is it, and I assume from what you're saying, it's a good, it's Netflix using their hour-long powers for good, not for tedium?
Yeah, there are a couple of episodes, particularly the last one, that feel like you could have shaved a little bit off, but generally they feel long because they're, you know, the horror tension right. of it. It's a lot of, like, you know, it's not a lot of jump scares, which is nice, so it's not, the horror aspect of it is not a lot of, like, you know, cats jumping out of corners and people are like, oh my god, and it's like, oh, it's just a cat, and then doing that for, like, fucking the whole thing, which is what, like, half horror movies are now. Instead, it's a lot of, like, very, like, slow shots down hallways and lights playing in shadows and you looking and being like, is that a ghost? Is that, like, a statue? And, like, there's a lot of really nice camera work and really nice editing that, like, really slowly builds up the tension. I will say there's one sequence in, I think it's episode 6. It's either episode 5 or 6. I don't remember which. But it is an episode that is basically built around 3 or 4 really big kind of one takes, you know, like the kind of prestige TV thing that they like to do. And the first one of those runs the whole gamut in a way that really impressed me, of being like, oh, this is kind of cool that they're doing this too. Oh, this is kind of obnoxious that they're doing this too. This is actually impressive that they've been doing this for this long too. It's kind of obnoxious that they've been doing this for this long too. I can't fucking believe they've maintained this one take thing for this long and it's this complicated. And it was like, it ended at the right note for me, of like that sort of like sine wave or whatever, of like, no, I'm actually totally into this.
Nice.
The way that all those shots and scenes kind of go for me is like, you have to end on like the up curve and then I'm like, good. If you end on the down curve, then it just feels like dumb and pretentious.
Yeah, no, I get that. That's cool. I asked about length just because I did go on a minor Twitter rant this week about the length of Netflix shows, because I think everyone is, because I kind of wanted to check out that new Sabrina show they have, which looks kind of cool. And I opened up the app and the first episode was 65 minutes long and every other episode was at least 58 minutes long. And I just said, no, that show of all shows needs to be 42 minutes. It needs to commit 42 minutes, tight 42, and I will watch it. And if Netflix wants to charge me $5 more a month to edit down their hour-longs to 42 minutes like any other good God-fearing TV show, I will watch it and I will pay that money. But until they add the reasonably paced option to their service, I don't think I can watch most of their hour-longs. But maybe I'll make an exception for this one because it has the Sean Chapman seal of approval.
Yeah, because I generally agree with you for other stuff, like, you know, like with Luke Cage and Jessica Jones in particular had that problem. This one, it feels like it gives you this nice long time to really, like, sink into an episode.
Well, and it's an anthology kind of thing, as you said, that it's like a different character and it's got a focus and the episodes are actual episodes, not just pieces of a 13-hour long movie that they like to do.
Yeah.
So I totally get it for that show. I don't know why the Sabrina the Teenage Witch show has to run an hour long. And I'm not trying to be demeaning to the show. Most shows don't need to. Most shows don't in the history of TV. So anyway. All right, cool. I've been watching a TV show, Sean.
TV show, Sean. Who's that?
I got your name wrong. 261 episodes, and I still once in a while get your name wrong. That's weird.
Yeah, I love TV show, Sean, but we're so close that I just call him TV show, Kun.
Well, I've been watching Dragon Ball Super, where Goku likes to call the god of the entire universe Zenchan. So I've been thinking a lot about honorifics. No, I've been watching Dragon Ball Super. I just started today the Universe Survival arc, the last and by far longest arc of the series, because it's like 55 episodes. So I'm not by any means in the home stretch by saying I'm on the last arc, but I'm loving it so much. I finished the Future Trunks arc this week, and by finished the Future Trunks arc, I mean on Monday, the day after we recorded this, the last podcast, I watched 9 episodes of Dragon Ball Super in one day.
Nice.
I don't think I've ever done that with this show, with any Dragon Ball property. Like, it was not all in a row. It was broken up during the day, but I did watch 9 episodes because it was so fucking good, and every episode was just so well-paced, and the animation was great, and the acting was great, and it had amazing character moments for Trunks and Goku and Vegeta, and it was genuinely unpredictable, and when all the truth about Zamasu and Goku Black came out, I was like, oh my god, this is crazy. And then they had some fights, and I'm like, oh my god. And then Vegito came out, and I'm like, I can't handle this. And then Trunks does a thing with his sword that is the coolest thing to ever happen on television. We can just call it a day. TV will never get better. And then the last episode of the Future Trunks arc is really bad, and it's confusing, and it's way too rushed, and it ends on a very low down note. But fuck it, that thing with the sword was really cool.
Yes, you need to go and look at, go on YouTube and just look at the dramatic finish from Dragon Ball FighterZ that they added when they put in Merged Zamasu as one of the characters, because it is nice. Trunks does the whole sword. It is one of the most spectacular things I've ever seen a fighting game do. Like, it's just fucking amazing looking.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's great.
I do not have the DLC for that game yet, but now I want it even more, because Merged Zamasu is pretty cool. It's such a good arc. It does shit the bed in that last episode. Like, that last episode is a fucking mess. But, like, Dragon Ball arcs don't always have the strongest endings. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. But I'm, you know, I don't know. I can handle it. You know, this show's got a lot of episodes. If one of them's not that good, whatever. That thing with the sword was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Dragon Ball is definitely a series that's about, like, the journey, not the destination kind of thing. Like, it's because that's the way that Toriyama wrote, was, like, very much a seat, you know, by the seat of his pants, like, whatever's happening is whatever's happening, and fuck planning ahead. Like, he'll do it occasionally for things that are very important, but generally it was like, this thing is really cool, so we're going to be doing this really cool thing right now.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, Dragon Ball is not these kind of self-contained arcs that have to end like that either. Like, and the ones that do, he generally did very well. Like, the Piccolo Daimao arc, which is the end of Kid Goku, has an amazing finish with Goku flying through Piccolo's chest.
Yeah.
And the Cell arc, which also predates a massive time jump, has an amazing ending. But, you know, like, the end of Dragon Ball Z is not that good. You know, the thing with Ub. Yeah. Like, the thing with Ub that in no way can happen now with what they've done in Super.
Yeah, like, so much time has passed that was supposed to take place before that epilogue that now is like, no, this is definitely, this must be after that. I mean, no, it's not, because Pan's not that old, but it's like, yes.
I would just say that, like, in the epilogue, there's the line where Bulma says, oh, hey, Goku, I haven't seen you in 5 years, and Dragon Ball Super does not paint a picture of this gang having, like, gone astray in the intervening years. That's what, more than anything else, like, Goku has ascended to godhood. That's one thing you think might come up. But other than that, yeah. No, it's okay, though. Like, again, continuity. They blew up the moon twice. I don't care. Future Trunks arc, very good. I like it a lot. Then they do a big series of filler episodes, like 10 to 12 episodes. And those 10 to 12 episodes are so good. They are so much fun. Like, there's my favorite one is the one where Ciampa and all of the warriors from Universe 6 come and they play baseball. And
I just
about died laughing at that. I think it is the best piece of Dragon Ball filler since Goku and Piccolo got their driver's licenses. Those two, that's the pinnacle of Dragon Ball filler, is those two on a shelf together. But there were some other really good ones. Like, there's my other favorite was the two-parter about Gohan being in a Great Saiyaman movie. And, like, it kind of explores his relationship with Videl a little bit and with himself as, like, he's a scholar, but he also is this guy who can fight. And that was really interesting. And there's the two-parter where Goku hires Hit to assassinate him so he can fight Hit again. And in the first episode, Goku just fucking dies and they leave it as a cliffhanger and it's crazy. And you get the whole, like, flashback to Hit on his own planet, like, getting... it's not his planet, but wherever he's from in Universe 6, and he's, like, getting the assassination orders, and it's basically Blade Runner, but with Hit in it, and now I want that spinoff where Hit is in Blade Runner, because Hit is an amazing character. It's a really fun series of episodes, and I kind of would love, if they, like, run out of long-term story ideas, they should just do, like, a 26-episode anime order of just Dragon Ball stories, and just, like, do one or two episode arcs with just, like, just pick a side character. Like, you could do one about Boo and Mr. Satan, and you could go to, like, the characters we've seen in these episodes, or you could go further afield, like, what's Tenshinhan up to? I don't know. Just, like, I would want the lunch two-parter, where we finally see what happened to her, because it's been a while. You know, Kame's day off. Not Kame Senin, Kame, just the turtle, where the turtle is off doing things. Because they're so good, and if they're that good when the team is, let's be honest, just killing time until the next arc... how good could it be if they were really like, that's the show and they're planning for it? I think that could be a fun thing to do one day if, you know, they feel like, we don't have time to, like, write a big arc here. Let's do something different with our creative energy. Because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. I would love one that is just, like, a day in the life of Karin in his tower.
Yes.
Like, fucking... because he's, particularly Dragon Ball Z, he's just, like... you know, he became outdated so quickly once they introduced his... Kami, but since he's the dude with the senzu beans, like, you would just, like, in the Android and Cell stuff, you just kind of, Goku would just pop up there every once in a while, and it's just like, oh, hey, Goku, last time I saw you, you were, like, barely a Super Saiyan, and now, you know, like, you're as powerful as Cell, but only one day has passed from my point of view, and I felt like I just gave you senzu beans, like, fucking 5 hours ago, but now you're right back here again with eating a bunch of senzu beans. It's like, the world from his point of view must be so strange.
I would love that. There is an episode of, I think it's the Future Trunks arc, where Goku goes to get senzu beans, and he, Karin and Yajirobe are playing, Limbo.
Yeah.
And they've got the, like, they're lowering the bar and they're like measuring the centimeters, and Karin is like really trying, and I would watch a whole episode of that. It made me laugh very hard.
Yeah.
So that's all good.
Yeah, I also agree with you that that baseball one is a particular favorite of mine. I rewatched that episode specifically like a month or two ago just because I really needed to rewatch the joke where they, you know, they do the Yamcha hole. You know,
yes.
And like Yamcha's just whole thing in that episode as like the one guy who knows how to play baseball but who ain't shit and in anything else is the fucking funniest thing in the world to me. It's the best use of Yamcha since blowing Yamcha up with the Cyberman. It was a big period of obscurity. You know, occasionally got a hole punch in his chest, but generally they didn't use Yamcha that much, and then they brought him back for that, and it's great.
It's so good. So I loved all of that. It's very fun. And then the Universe Survival arc starts, and I'm two episodes into it, and I've obviously got a long way to go. Couple of reactions. One, they updated the animation style, and holy crap, is it good. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to suss out exactly what they're doing. They have not, it's still Tadayoshi Yamamuro on character design, so they haven't changed the art style. But, like, the way they finish it, like, the digital ink and paint techniques look much more handcrafted and smoother, and I'm really loving that. It's very cool. The new theme song, Genkai Toppa X Survivor, is the fucking shit. I love it. I've been listening to it, like, on a loop, and also just that opening, I cannot skip it. It's just too good, and it is just, it's all the hype. I love it, because most of the theme songs they've done since Z have been, like, trying to do Chala Hedgela, you know?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Dragon Soul on Kai, and the other Kai openings that they did for the Buu arc, and then Chozetsu Dynamic. I like all of those to varying degrees. I think Chozetsu Dynamic is very, very good. But they are, like, they're trying to be Hedgela. Genkai Toppa is not. It's got, actually, a quote of Hedgela in there, but it is its own kind of song that Dragon Ball has never really used as a theme song before, and the animation for the opening is very different and much more, like, energetic, and it gets you pumped in the way that I feel like this arc probably wants to get you pumped, and I love that. We get more of Zenchan, who I think is an amazing character. Just every time they go up the ladder of gods, it gets even closer to what I think is Toriyama's id, and I think Zenchan is very close to that.
Yes. Yeah, I think it also just gets closer to probably Toriyama's, like, legitimate perspectives, like, religious perspectives on the universe. Like, I think that Zeno is, like, legitimately what Toriyama thinks, like, how the universe is created and how we live and how we will die one day.
Yes. So I've got a long way to go in this arc, and I'm excited to watch it. I will say, these first two episodes do have me questioning, because in these first two episodes, if you haven't seen them, this is where Bulma is now pregnant with the baby who will be Bra, her daughter, at the end of Z. So they are aware of the end of Z, that that's coming. But she is pregnant again. Somehow, Goten and Trunks still haven't aged. I feel like they're going to need to address that at some point. That they've not aged at all, which is weird. But anyway, so she's pregnant, and Vegeta does not want to go train with Goku because he's trying to be a good husband. And not even trying to be. He just kind of is at this point, you know?
He's a much better husband and father than Goku ever has been.
That's my point. It's like, he is a caring, like, he is there when he needs to be there. And, like, he's not Father of the Year or anything, but he is a totally competent father and husband, whereas Goku is the worst at both of those things. And I love that, like, what Goku does in those first two episodes in trying to get Zeno to hold this tournament is he puts 11/12 of the universe at risk, because Zeno decides the way the tournament is going to go is they're just going to wipe out fucking universes if they lose. Goku has arguably done the worst thing we've ever seen anyone do in Dragon Ball in those two episodes, and Vegeta is being, like, the good husband and father. I think at this point you can make the argument Vegeta is a more moral character than Goku is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would agree. I think that that point was around when he decides to sacrifice himself in the Boo arc, is when it's like,
maybe.
Oh, because, like, you know, Goku's not evil, but, like, I don't know how I would describe his moral character. It's like, it's more just like he is a loyal person that, like, looks out for his buddies, but not in this, like, he's not trying to do good. He's just
Vegeta,
like, he just doesn't want to be cool.
Morality, right?
Yes, yeah. Like, Vegeta knows evil, he makes the conscious choice to do good. Whereas, like, Goku is, you know, this, like, innocent baby throughout his whole life. And, like, he's just not being cruel. That's all he's doing.
I do have an issue with how simplistic Goku's characterization gets in Super. And I'm interested to hear if you think if they get to a more complex stage later in the series with this, where they really have distilled him down in Super just to, he wants to fight stronger people, and he will go to any lengths to do that. And that is very much core to Goku, but I do think there's a little more to him in the original, you know, Toriyama manga and anime, in that he's into that, but, like, when the shit hits the fan, he will put that to the side and get serious and fight, and he will have some sense of, it's not like in the dub they gave him the Superman speech about how I am the hope of the universe. He would never say that, but he will be like, okay, I'm fighting Frieza is good, but I also just, I need to beat this guy because he's trying to destroy my family and my planet and all that stuff. And, like, he has, like, a sense of, if nothing else, just, like, I don't know, like, objective, like, reality that this is bad and I have to deal with this. I think they got back to that a little bit in the Future Trunks arc, in that Goku stops fucking around as much as he has in other arcs, and it's just like, okay, this is really bad, let's figure out how to solve it. Like, I like when Goku gets to those weightier moments, and I don't know, in part because a lot of Super, the plots are, the weight is a little off of Goku and onto, like, the literal gods. I think they allow him to be his most, like, simplistic id side of himself. But what I do, at a certain point, it becomes almost too stale as a protagonist. So I don't know if the universe survival arc gets beyond that, because they've definitely built in something that Goku, like, has to atone for here. And there's a potential character arc I'd be interested in seeing if that happens.
Yeah, I would say that they definitely play around with the, like, Goku is low-key maybe, like, responsible for this whole weird scenario. Like, that aspect of it gets a lot more complicated than where you're at right now. But I do think that, like, I would agree with you that sometimes they go for, like, the very easy characterization of Goku. But I think, like, I don't know if they ever really get to where Goku is in a lot of Dragon Ball Z, where he's more of that, like, serious Goku. Like, Goku fighting Cell, or Goku in the Boo arc, where, like, he's training Goten and Trunks with the fusion dance, like, that kind of mode that he gets into. I don't think he ever really goes back to that place, but it kind of feels like, for me, he's kind of moved, in a weird way, he's kind of come full circle, where he has moved into this place where he is, like, he has become that sort of, like, martial art, kind of, like, martial artist, like ideal, you know? And,
yeah.
And so, it is selfish in a way, but it is also, like, necessary for him to advance himself. I think they play with that, but not in ways that, like, you've seen before in Dragon Ball. And it's a bit more, it's not, like, very direct, but I think there's a conversation to be had that I don't want to spoil stuff, but of how they use Goku and how they play with how Goku goes through the tournament and the way that he does evolve as a character, but in a different way than he did in Dragon Ball Z.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, they've definitely, like, because the whole Battle of Gods movie was, in a sense, an effort by Toriyama to reclaim Goku, who had been, I think, in the other theatrical films that he had no hand in, been pushed too far into the, like, I'm a superhero zone, which he is not. Goku is, I mean, he is superhero-ic, but he's not Superman, right?
Yeah.
And there's often in the movies, especially the original 13Z movies, there's too much of, like, I'm heroic and I'm righteous. And Goku never has a sense of, like, righteousity to him. And then I think also in just the intervening years in, like, the international community had gotten too much to that. And Battle of Gods really was about, let's get back to, like, the core of who he is. But I also think in that movie he has a sense of weight. And I just, yeah, I'm curious to see where it goes. I think it's ebbed and flowed for me in Super. Goku's always a very, very fun character to have around. So, like, there's no, it's not like, oh God, I don't want to watch this anymore because Goku's too simple. You know, it's Goku. And they've got him, like, 90% there's just like a little 10% once in a while I feel like I'm missing.
Yeah, I think it's also a consequence of elevating Vegeta to the level of narrative importance that he's at, is that, like, Goku has to contrast Vegeta really heavily, because part of what happened in Z was, you know, it became such an ensemble kind of thing, where Goku's role in Dragon Ball Z is typically the, like, it changes in Majin Buu stuff quite a bit, but typically for, like, the Saiyan, Frieza, Android Cell stuff, all of that is, like, Goku's out of commission, when does Goku come back? And, like, that's when, like, Goku gets to come back and be that more serious version of himself, because the lens is taken off of him for such huge stretches of Dragon Ball Z. And so the Dragon Ball Super puts him back into, like, a square, like, protagonist chair alongside Vegeta. And so, yeah, I think you kind of lose the convenience of being able to see him from a distance and kind of make him seem a little bit cooler because you don't have to sit with him all the time.
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, because there is definitely that sense, like, when you get to Z, Goku had been the main character in every, you know, panel of Dragon Ball up to that point. And then there was, I think, a very clear sense by Toriyama of, I want to expand the palette here. And in Super, the palette is somewhat condensed because Goku is back to, he's in every panel, but with Vegeta. I mean, definitely the whole thing. I do find the show really interesting. My favorite thing about Super is it's Dragon Ball Super. It's not Dragon Ball Z. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It does feel like this is not an attempt to do Z again. It's an attempt to do something new with Dragon Ball. It's, I think, not always 100% successful, like those first two retelling arcs of the movies. But when it's on very hard, and I am interested in that. And I'm okay with them, like, swinging and missing a couple of times, as with, you know, moments where I feel like Goku's a little off, than I would be if they were just trying to recreate the dynamic of Z, which they're really not trying to do at all, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's a cool show, so I'm really liking it. Crunchyroll is a good service, so I'm having fun watching it on there now, because I'm out of Blu-rays.
Yes, that's right.
Funimation is getting those out very slowly, which I don't 100% understand the business strategy behind that one, but that's okay, Funimation, you do you.
Well, I think they're airing it on Toonami still, right?
That's a good point, yeah.
That's probably why they're, like, keeping the releases in pace with that.
That makes sense, yeah. They're still going to be airing that on Toonami when, like, the movie comes out.
Yes, yeah, they will.
Yeah. Like, we all remember that, like, it's like, now that Super's on Crunchyroll, we're all like, they got their shit together. It did take them a full year to get it on there, though. So, like, everyone in the Americas and in the English-speaking world had, like, a very long lead time to have to deal with on that. Yeah. At least we're getting the movie in a month, so that'll be good. Not a month from now, I mean a month from when it comes out. Okay, so that is Dragon Ball. Let's talk about one piece of news this week, Sean. This is a sad piece of news. Filmstruck, the streaming service best known for the Criterion Channel, it was the service where all of Criterion's content had migrated, is shutting down after just 2 years. It will be gone at the end of November. They sent a note out to subscribers. There will be refunds. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to work for those who had time left over after November. New management after the AT&T Time Warner merger did not want to have the service anymore. Filmstruck, I should say, was a part of TCM, Turner Classic Movies, which was a subsidiary of Warner Brothers, which is a subsidiary of Time Warner. Time Warner merged with AT&T, and they decided, no more niche services. We want to have bigger streaming services. They basically put out a statement saying that like, we're proud of Filmstruck, but it's too nerdy. Fuck all you nerds. And they decided to pants us all and get rid of Filmstruck. And I looked over at my Criterion Collection discs and I said, I wasn't a fool for spending money on you, but I feel really bad that Filmstruck is gone.
Yeah, no, it was a great service that, like, I would subscribe to intermittently when, like, there was something on it I really wanted to watch. I do, like, one thing that always really frustrated me about it is that, you know, it's been around since 2016 and they still had not made an app for the Xbox or the PS4. So if I wanted to watch it, I had to hook up my laptop to my TV, which is very annoying. But other than that, yeah, like, one of the great things about Filmstruck was that it was not just, like, obviously great repository of films and everything that they had with access to Turner Classic Movies and the Criterion Collection. But on top of that, they also had so much of the bonus material that you could access from that subscription, which is not stuff that other subscription services typically do, which always really frustrates me if you have, like, a movie that's on Netflix that, like, why not have the director's commentary be an audio option? Like, why not have there be a section that you can go see the deleted scenes or whatever was on, like, the original DVD release of this movie or whatever it is? Like, that's something that feels like it's a weird way that streaming services it made sense 10 years ago that streaming services, when they were getting started, didn't have that stuff. Now that we have, you know, like simultaneous releases of like international movies on Netflix that have like 5 different language options, both in audio dubs and in subtitles that you can switch between very easily and stuff, it seems very weird to me that that is not something that is caught up there a little bit. And it was always the thing that stood out to me about Filmstrike is that they cared enough that it's like, if you subscribe to that service, you're not just getting the movies, you're getting all the extraneous material that we have compiled around those movies available to you as well.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Criterion was on Hulu before this, and the Hulu collection was great. It had most of Criterion's catalog, but it didn't have all that other stuff that you're talking about. And it wasn't as finely curated, because Filmstruck would also, like, highlight things on their service. They wouldn't just shit it all out there and leave you to your devices the way Netflix or Hulu, you know, will do, where they just like release and release and release and they never look back at old stuff. They would often highlight, like, we're going to have a week on, you know, black filmmakers, or we're going to have a week on, you know, this segment of Asia or something like that. And they would do these kinds of really cool curated events. And yeah, they had all the bonus features. It was as close to what I think everyone wanted out of the Criterion Collection streaming service that we knew one day kind of had to come from this disc-based company. And it's gone. I don't think that means Criterion will never be on the web again. Like, I think people are being a little too doom and gloom about that. I like, the doom and gloom is that, oh God, this didn't work. Can anything like this work? I guess my perspective is this didn't work because it became part of one of the single biggest transnational corporations in the world. An AT&T time, like, I'm surprised it ever existed under Time Warner. They don't give a shit about this. Like, you know, Warner Brothers has the Warner Archive, which is nice. I think that could also go the way of the dodo soon, so buy what you want off of that. But, you know, at a certain point, like, you know, I do not expect, for instance, the Disney streaming service to have every Mickey Mouse black and white short on it, you know?
Yeah.
That would be very easy for them, but the marginal cost of that, they don't care. They're going to be putting on, you know, Moana and stuff. I do think there is a way you could do a Criterion streaming service and have it be fiscally viable. I think it's probably going to cost more than $10 a month, because I think it will just cost more to upkeep and not have the same, you know, payment for them as a Netflix or something. Like, not everything can do the exact Netflix business model, because most people don't have the Netflix subscriber rates. But look, Criterion has a collection that is the envy of the entire world when it comes to foreign and classic film. And if there's a way for them to get that out there online and make even a little bit of money from that, they will do it. I would not be surprised if they wind up going back to Hulu, because I think Hulu seems generally open to that kind of stuff. Like, Hulu has a much better focus on classical television than other streaming services like Netflix, so that would not surprise me. It would also not surprise me if there winds up being kind of a bidding war among other streaming services to get this content, because even if it's marginal to them, it is a lot of stuff. And I also think it's possible that Criterion just at some point goes on their own for this, because again, for their long-term viability, I think Blu-rays and DVDs are going to be around for a long time as a niche product. Again, you can still go buy CDs as much as people buy music online. But I think for their long-term viability, they're going to need some kind of streaming option. I think that will happen. I think we will be without it for a while, and that sucks. Again, if you have your physical media discs, cling to them. Cling to them desperately, because streaming things can go away at any moment. I see Sean reaching for his Zatoichi box set,
yes,
which you bought at the exact perfect moment.
Yeah, it does. It felt, when I saw that announcement, it felt like I had, like, sensed something in, like, the web of the universe or something. There was a vibration that was just, like, called out to me, get Zatoichi, just in case, get it, and hold it tight. Because I feel like that's something I said last week on the show offhandedly, is like, well, I wanted to have it, and, you know, just, like, in the off chance that, like, anything happens with Filmstruck, and then now something has happened with Filmstruck, but I have Zatoichi with me forever.
It's funny, because in the most recent... Yeah, it's funny because in the most recent Criterion sale, I bought a couple of things and I felt a little guilty about it. Like, should I still be spending money on this when there's Filmstruck and I could just get that and spend less money and I'd have all this stuff, you know, not in the same quality as Blu-ray, but, you know, close to it. And I was kind of thinking, and then this happened and it's like, yeah, even if they do this again, like, streaming services are extremely transient, especially if you need it for, like, education or scholarly purposes like I do. Nothing is better than having an actual physical disc that you own and control and can copy and can do things with. So, you know, I think we should all remember that. You know, the only reason the Criterion Collection exists in the first place is because of physical media sales. You know, in the time when physical media sales eventually go away entirely, there's not going to be the money to do the kind of work they do because, again, a Criterion Collection disc retails for $40. Filmstruck was $11.99 a month. You do the math on that. What do they get more money on? They get more money on the discs. And that's how they are able to afford restorations and rescuing all the films they rescue and presenting in such great quality the better-known films they present. So, you know, support Criterion. They're a great company. Mourn Filmstruck. If you want access to classical films right now and you don't have Filmstruck and now no longer can sign up, I would recommend going to your local library, getting a card, and getting a Canopy account. Canopy is a wonderful service that is entirely free and is done by basically a consortium of libraries and pretty much any public library service. You can get access to that, and they have lots and lots of stuff, including stuff Filmstruck did not have, like a lot of silent films, which is cool. So there are options, and I would recommend seeking those out. You know, your local library might also have a good collection of Criterion discs themselves, and you could watch those. But this is a sad day for classic film.
Yeah. But again, I'm with you that I think that something like Filmstruck will come around with Criterion, but it will, like, it will be and needs to be a more premium service kind of thing. Like, that's just, like, that's the nature of what their physical media is, and it's the nature of, like, I think what a digital service would have to be. Because it already was a premium service. It already gave you access, like I said, to more, it gave you access to written content, and it gave you access to video content that they had made for those DVD releases. And I would expect to pay more for a Filmstruck than I would pay for Netflix because of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. All right, so let's go ahead and move on. Sean, topic one for today is Red Dead Redemption 2, the big game of 2018, the first Rockstar game of this generation, which is crazy to think about because we've all played GTA 5 on our PS4, but it came out on PS3 and 360 originally, so this is their entree into the new generation. That is not new anymore, and a long-anticipated game, because Red Dead 1 was 8 full years ago now, 2010. We were both in fucking high school when that game came out, scrounging pennies together to buy video games. We were not gainfully employed. And, yeah, now we are playing Red Dead Redemption 2. And I gotta tell you, Sean, I am hugely impressed by this game. And I am impressed by how much it feels like in every aspect of it, nearly every aspect. There's one issue I have with it. But in nearly every aspect I've encountered so far, this feels like such a more grown-up Rockstar to me than I have ever encountered. This does not feel like the Rockstar game pitched at our inner 16-year-old. It feels like a game made by and for adults, and I appreciate that hugely.
Yeah, I agree. It also just feels, for me, like, personally and specifically, it feels like they made the Red Dead sequel for me, because they put in all the stuff like cowboy dress up that I did in Red Dead that was not, like, fully supported by that game, but like the day-to-day life of a cowboy thing and the kind of cowboy simulator game I really wanted, that like Red Dead Redemption gave you a glimpse of, that is basically what Red Dead Redemption 2 is, and I'm very happy with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, let me just list off a couple of things that I think are exemplary about this game. I think the writing is outstanding. I think moment to moment, it's the best Rockstar writing I've ever heard. Some of just the best video game writing. Like, it feels more close to Naughty Dog than it does to Grand Theft Auto or something, where it's, you know, there are moments of levity and it can be funny, but it is not the, like, empty nihilistic satire of GTA, and it's not the, like, kind of crazy shenanigans of a lot of Red Dead 1 that we've all forgotten. like the crazy guy who's looking for dead people. And just like listening to these characters talk, the dialogue just crackles. I think it's amazing to listen to. It is so nuanced and thoughtful and interesting. I think the acting across the board is incredible, particularly the guy who plays Arthur Morgan, the main character. I could listen to that guy read me the phone book as a bedtime story, and I would fall asleep listening to that just beautiful Western drawl of his. He is probably my favorite Rockstar protagonist just because I love hanging out with this dude. But I think all the actors, like the guy who plays Dutch Vanderland, that's an incredible character so far, and I think what they're doing with that. I am impressed with this as a prequel. It being a prequel was one of the things that distanced me from it when it was announced, because I'm like, I've played Red Dead. I don't need more about the fucking Vanderland gang. I've seen that. And it turns out, no, I haven't. What this game does as a prequel is amazing. I think its world is outstanding. Its graphics, this looks like a next generation game. This does not look like a game I would play on my PS4. This looks like I've just bought new technology to play this game. It's unbelievable. All of that is amazing. My one issue is it controls like hot garbage, and someday someone's going to need to do an intervention with Rockstar about what the fuck their control methodology is, because it's fucked beyond belief. But everything else is so good, I'm pretty addicted to this game. So that's my opening salvo.
Like, I'm all of that, and I don't mind the controls. Like, I've always been someone that's like, I think like Rockstar is like trying to get at something that's really hard to get at with their controls, and they're always flawed, but I'm always interested in like the weight of the movement, and like it doesn't work all the time, but there's something about like the deliberateness of it that it doesn't feel like it controls that way because they're incompetent or they like or anything like that, or it's like they're making a big mistake. It feels like they're trying to do something very different than what video games typically do, and it adds something to the like cowboy simulator role play thing that I like to do with their games.
I get that. And so let's hold here for a second and talk about the controls. Because it's my only significant, like, qualitative issue with the game so far. I totally get that. But I also think that in the years since Red Dead 1 and GTA 5, we've seen a lot of games try to close that gap between controls and player and really try to make you feel like you're doing what the character is doing, but also make the controls intuitive and inviting. And there have been games that have threaded that needle in a way that I don't think existed before the last round of Rockstar games. Like, The Last of Us is a game that totally draws you into the physicality of its world, and it controls well. After a few hours with The Last of Us, I do not have to think about what button does what, whereas with Red Dead Redemption 2, I am constantly confused, what the fuck button am I supposed to push here? Will it do what I want it to do? 50-50 if it actually will. And there's stuff like that, you know. There are plenty of games that have used, like, weight and physicality of horses and people and things like that. You know, fantasy settings recently, like The Witcher 3 or something, where I do not feel as distanced from the controls. My issue with the controls of Red Dead 2 is that it's pretty much the controls of Red Dead 1 with way more layered on top of it, because it's a lot more added into this game to do. It's extremely complicated. Most of the time, again, I feel like I have to actively think about what the inputs are and what I'm supposed to do here. And in gunfights, I just die a lot from not quite being able to, like, do what I'm trying to do with the game. You know, you run your horse into fucking trees and shit. And some of that, I think, is okay. Like, I think some of their design philosophy around horses is still really interesting, because the horses do not feel like a vehicle, but like beings in the world. But at the same time, sometimes it's like, I don't want to be fucking tapping the X button to make them go fast. Why can't I just hold a trigger to make this horse move? So I guess at the end of the day, I understand where their design philosophy comes from on controls, but if the idea is to make you feel more like the characters in the game and feel the weight and physicality of this universe, it doesn't do that for me. It makes me feel more distanced, because it's constantly reminding me I'm playing a video game and I have to think about what I'm supposed to do here, and I think it is ultimately self-defeating. That's my ultimate feeling on that.
Yeah, like, I would say that definitely it's... because I think there's two things with the controls. There's, like, the movement and, like, the very deliberate, like, animation-based stuff they do with that, and it's, like, it is not... you know, it is not you pull back on the left stick and do like a 180 and Arthur just spins around on a disc the way, you know, in like a high-speed character action game a character would. You know, it's not like that. It's not like God of War for this year, which does a good job of doing both of those things, of feeling very responsive but also having the character feel very movement-based. And they did that by having the camera be super close in. And it's almost like it's not tank controls, but it evokes a certain sense that like Resident Evil 4 kind of had with its kind of tank control setup. So it's not doing those things, but it is having like the very deliberate animation kind of movement thing, which is something that I think a lot of people really hate right off the bat, and I do not blame them. I think it's 100% a taste thing, but I've just always been fine with that since they did it in Grand Theft Auto 4, and I think they've gotten better at doing that. So that's one element of the controls. The other element of the controls is like the literal like button inputs and the complexity of what they're asking you to do with the controller. And part of that is there is like... like you said, there are so many commands in this game, like contextual and otherwise. There's so many things you can do as your character that the control interface is very complicated. And there's like, you know, multiple toggles you can do with like with L2 and being able to bring up the dialogue thing and all of that. And to get like a huge list of different kind of context specific actions depending on who you're targeting, whether you're by your horse, like where you are in the environment, you know, whether you're by objects or enemies and all that kind of stuff. And there are occasional moments where, specifically related to like trying to do non-combat related things in a combat environment, like that is where I've had a couple of instances where the controls have tripped up on me past like the first 3 to 4 hours. But I feel like I've, at this point in the game, kind of sunk into and gotten used to, this is like what I need to press on the controller to do what I want to do. It's like, it definitely is a lot steeper of a learning curve than most video games have, because most video games have very standardized controls that Red Dead Redemption 2 very much does not, both because Rockstar like to do their thing and because this game has a tremendous amount of actions in it that other games just don't have at all, that I think contributes to that learning curve. But I feel like I'm at a point where I'm really comfortable, and I'm actually really enjoying the level of freedom that their control setup gives me to express myself in the game, with being able to holster and unholster guns and aim guns and do context-specific actions with like melee or communicating with people and or interacting with my horse in cool ways, that there's like a tremendous amount of freedom with different things you can do in the game. And I'm still like discovering and learning new things I can do by combining different actions and contexts together with the controls.
No, I agree. And it's an interesting thing because you're correct, there is so much they want you to be able to do in the game, and no single controller of a reasonable like size is going to let you do all of that with complete ease. And even if you had a controller with like 10 more buttons, it would just become more confusing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I totally get all that, and it's, again, I'm loving the game. This is, it's enough for, like, if it were this and then the rest of the game did not feel as sufficiently like new and vital and evolved to me, I think I would be much more frustrated. But I can definitely look past a lot of these issues. It's just things like, why in the mother of God is the X button still run and make your horse move and stuff like that? Because let's say I'm riding through the desert and I have to hold X to make my horse move and I want to go into the cinematic camera. Well, I would have to lift my thumb off the fucking button and go to the touchpad, which is where that would be, and then go back, and then it's like, am I getting it right? Am I doing it right? At this point, the UI is gone, so I'm not sure, and there's things like that. Or if I don't want to use cinematic camera, maybe as I'm riding my horse around, I would like to rotate the right stick and look at this amazing, beautiful, giant world they've done. Oh, fuck, I have to hold down the X button to make anything move in this game, so I cannot access the right stick as I do this. It's just, it feels like in the year 2018... why is movement not mapped to one of the triggers? Why is it not on a bumper? Like every other... why is it not like pressing a stick or something so you can have full mobility of the controller while you're moving, which is something that I feel like you would want to do to interact with this cool open world? Maybe there's a way to remap it. I couldn't find what it was.
It's standard FPS controls moves running to clicking in on the left stick.
What does it do for horses?
I'm not sure because I'm not using it, because I'm fine with the X button thing because I snake my right index finger over the top of the controller and move the right stick that way because I'm cool and weird.
Well, okay, but you shouldn't have to fucking jerry-rig your controller to do these things. Like,
you shouldn't, but it's like how I've played these games for so long that sure, like, it doesn't bother me, but I agree with you.
But doesn't
it
feel like stubbornness
weird
at a certain point that Rockstar has been doing it this way for 10 fucking years and they won't just move that one simple command to somewhere else on the controller?
I mean, I there's something about it that I actually like about like the rhythm of pressing the X button in time with the horse's gallop and stuff like that. There's a very kinesthetic kind of feel to it to me that I like. And since I've come up with a way for me that feels, again, since I've been doing this since playing Grand Theft Auto 4 or Red Dead Redemption 1, which has been a while, I'm very used to using my right index finger to move the... actually, that's something I did, I think, in Burnout Paradise when I originally played Burnout Paradise, because boost was on A in that game, and if I wanted to swivel the camera while I was boosting, I had to do that because that game was obviously using everything else already, so they kind of had to put the boost button down there. So I've just been doing that for a long time, so it works for me.
All
I
think I'll say you should
look at the different control options, because there's a couple of they're pretty customizable.
Because I remember I tried this on the PS4 Xbox One re-release of GTA 5, which was the first time they had remapping. And I did set running to the stick, but the way they do running as like a, you also then have to choose if you're toggling it or not toggling it. And in GTA, at least you had to like double tap to make him run, and it didn't work. It just didn't work with how the game like moved and controlled like in North. So I was like scared off of it this time. So I'm making it work. It's fine. I'm getting used to it more and more. And certainly there are things like the weight of the characters I like, actually, and in general I like the sheer amount of animations. Sometimes I wish it just felt a little cleaner, like when I'm trying to go grab something and tiny little movements of the character will be like, oh, there's five different things I can grab here, and there's just, and I frequently do the thing I'm intending not to do or something like that. That can be frustrating. But, you know, I think half of this is the cost of doing business with a game that is very complicated and trying to do a lot of kinds of inputs, and that I'm fine with because there's no perfect solution to it. And the other half feels like, I want this to be a little tighter, and I think they could make it a little tighter. Like some of the, this game definitely for me still lags as like a third-person shooter compared to a lot. Although not as bad as like GTA 5 because it's the Old West, so if it feels a little wonky, that's okay. You're shooting with like old fucking wooden guns. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, are you playing with the lock-on or in free aim for the
whatever shooting? The default is?
Okay, yeah, I personally would recommend. This is what I've done since Red Dead Redemption. I think was the first time they did this, and there was definitely an option in Grand Theft Auto 5. And this is not going to be for everybody. And I think you should leave lock-on for the horse combat stuff because that's really hard to aim manually no matter what, so you should probably have lock on there. But I switched to free aim for like on ground combat, which means that it does not like hard snap to people. And then you really do go in and fiddle with the sensitivity options because you have sensitivity, look acceleration, and dead zone. So this is a bit complicated for people that aren't interested in that stuff, but I really appreciate that they give you the options. And so I was able in like the first hour or two of play, be able to kind of like zero in on what feels comfortable for me for like looking in like the speed of aiming in the game. And so now I'm just playing it on free aim, and that makes the combat a lot more interesting to me than snap to somebody, boom, 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 snap to somebody else. And there's all the stuff they do with like aim wob and stuff be based on like where your stats are at and whether or not you just took a hit and whether or not you were sprinting. Like they mess with your aim a lot in the game in a way that I really like. That's like, it's not super responsive and like it's not a like very satisfying third person shooter in the traditional sense, but I'm very much looking at this game as this sort of like cowboy roleplay experience. Yeah. And for that sense, the like running behind cover and slamming behind like a big rock and pulling out my like, you know, lever action repeater rifle and going over the edge of it and having my aim swim all over the place and then like sort of like barely sneak in a shot with like my wobbling rifle into a guy's head, like that feels really satisfying and like a really compelling, again, like expression of this kind of like Western cowboy thing I want to do with the game. And I like the shooting in that regard. But yes, if you're looking for like a really good, competent third-person shooter that feels really snappy and nice and has like really complicated combat scenarios, like that's not this game at all.
No. But I agree. Like, and I think the more I'm playing it, the more I'm getting used to these different things. Because again, like Rockstar plays by their own fucking rules. And so if you're going to pick up Red Dead 2... It's just going to be a massive learning curve, you know?
Yeah.
And a relearning. Even if you've played every other Rockstar game to completion or something, as we have since GTA 4, you know, so like, and I totally get that, and I think it is, the more I play it, the more rewarding it is to engage with all of that, which is a great thing about a game this big and dense. And I agree with what you say about, like, there's something very satisfying about how much the combat does add, like, at its best, that element of the cowboy sim. But anyway, I outlined all these different places we could take this conversation. There is the writing, and there is the performances, and there is the graphics, and there's so many amazing things. I think one of the places I want to start here is just something that we're going to be grappling with for a while, talking about this game, Sean, is the fucking size of it, and the scale, and that... Mm-hmm. You know, this game comes on 2 Blu-ray discs, and it takes an hour to install if you're doing it that way. And if you get it digitally, I assume it takes many hours to download because it's 100 gigabytes, and that's just the size of the file. And then when you get in there, the world is big, and there are lots of characters, and there are all these things you can do, as we were talking about, with control inputs, and there are a bajillion interlocking systems going on in this game. It's sort of like, you know, Witcher 3 and Breath of the Wild and Last of Us and all these other like recent kind of survival and third person and adventure games got thrown into a pot, and then they added way more seasonings on top of that, and then all the Old West stuff. And so there's so much, and yet one of the things I'm very impressed by with the game so far is I don't feel overwhelmed. I feel like it's easing you into all that very well. In part because I think Rockstar has always been good at this part of it, of building an open world and having their stories serve as a good tour of that open world, where they do not overwhelm you too fast, they do not push you to, like, go to the whole map right away. If they're going to keep you in one part of the map, they're going to have you really explore and get to know that area. So, like, I've seen a fraction of the map so far, honestly, but I feel like I really know that area. And one of the things I'm thinking of is, like, last year's Assassin's Creed Origins, which is apparently a much shorter game than this year's Assassin's Creed Odyssey, is a game that had this giant fucking map and a story that just rushed you through it, of like, you're going to do one mission here, you're barely going to get to know the area, and then you're going to go to another area, and in the 40-hour campaign, it felt exhausting to me. This game probably has a bigger map than that, but it does not feel exhausting in that sense. In fact, this is a very slow and methodical game, and I think it's a great approach to leveraging what is an extraordinary open world they have built.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And one of the things that it does that really facilitates that is this, like, this is I'm so positive on Red Dead Redemption 2 that it's like, I don't even know how to express it sometimes. I think the easiest way to express it is they just took Red Dead Redemption 1 and then they just, like, took a big old helping of Shenmue and dumped it onto Red Dead Redemption 1, because that's really, that's what this game feels like, is it has, like, the huge grandeur and scope of a Rockstar open world game, but it, you know, obviously it's not as densely detailed as Shenmue 1 was, because it couldn't be, because Shenmue 1 is just, like, one little shopping district, basically. It's, like, two streets. So it's like in Shenmue, every single character is named. Every single character has, like, a little story that they play out, that they have, like, their own life that they go, and they have a job. Like, they're, like, literally every single person in the game has that component to them. They all live somewhere and they all go through their daily life and they have friends and they chat. Like, that's, like, part of the beauty of, like, the behind the scenes sort of magic of Shenmue 1. Red Dead Redemption 2, obviously, that is not every single character is like that. Because, you know, you go into the cities and 99% of the NPCs in the game are strangers or whatever. If you look at them with L2, that they're just called strangers and they're a bit generic, but they communicate so much about the world and the people in it in a way that evokes that kind of detail and that kind of life and that kind of, you know, sense of time passing and things changing. That's so important to me to make the world feel really tangible, and it doesn't, like, and that's the thing that sets this world apart from other Rockstar open worlds and almost any other open world other than, like, a Shenmue, or in a different kind of way Persona has this as well, and it's one of the reasons I like Persona, is that sense of the world feeling very real and tangible and there, and I am there in it. And a part of that is just the passage of time feels real in this game to me. Even if there's no calendar, even if there's no, like, you know, it doesn't do the Shenmue thing of every time you go to sleep it comes up with, like, the next day, and if you just sleep over and over again for, like, 60 times in a row or something, April come around and the game ends because you've missed your deadline to catch Land D or whatever in that game. It doesn't do that. It doesn't, like, simulate winter and spring. It doesn't do all of it. But when I, like, come right in back to the camp after, like, doing a couple of missions, and I, like, get off and, like, hitch my horse and go, maybe I pass, you know, Lenny or somebody, and I'll say, hey, Lenny, what's up? And it's like, hey, Morgan, how you doing? Oh, I'm pretty good, man. It's like, you have a good night. It's like, you have a good night too, Mr. Morgan. And then I go into my camp, and I go, and I sit down on my bunk, and I go to sleep until the morning. I get up, I shave, I pick out my clothes for the day, because the first thing I did when I got any amount of money in the game was I went right to the general store and bought a shit ton of clothes so I've worn a different outfit basically every single day, and sometimes I'll keep the jacket, but, like, that shirt's dirty. I'm not wearing that shirt. I'm putting on a different pair of shirt. Maybe I have a new pair of boots. I bought a new hat the other day I'm going to try out. Then I get up and I go and I chat with, you know, fucking Dutch over by the pot, and, like, while I'm drinking coffee. And then I say, oh, that was cool. Now I'm going to go, and what should I do today? Oh, I'm going to ride into town and get a new gun, because I just got that money from that last thing I did. And then maybe I'll ride over here, and because one of the other members of the gang is over by this, like, homestead, and I need to do a mission. And then once I do that, it's nighttime, and then maybe I don't make it all the way back to my home camp, but I stop in Valentine and go get a hotel room, take a bath, sleep in the hotel room, get up, and then ride back to camp. And there's that sense of, like, I have these days that I spent in the game that are days. And then you go to sleep and you wake up and the next day starts, and it's like the start of a new adventure. And that does so much to me to make me feel like this. I am living in this world, and that this world is changing, and like the characters in the camp are not repeating dialogue all the time. I'm so impressed by my not moving the story forward, and people still having new shit to say to me when all I've been doing is like hunting for the past 2 days or something, and they still have something new to talk about. And all of that does so much to me of feeling like I could spend like 100 hours just in this little bit here and making out my life here and getting new clothes and checking, like, sometimes riding a little further field and checking out a new town. But basically I like my little camp with my homies and the little Valentine town right nearby that I can ride to really quick if I need something there. And I don't kind of like, I'm kind of fine not moving on for now. I'm just like really content being in this one area and really thoroughly exploring all of it. And there's so much density and so much there to see and explore that I've played like over 10, probably like over 12 hours in this one little space, basically, and still have not gotten tired of it and do not have the urge to move on from it yet.
It's amazing. It's a magic trick. I really do like, I agree with everything you said. And what it is, you know, when I'm out in the world doing, for me, crazy crime shenanigans, we'll talk about all this, how we're playing the game. Because 16-year-old Jonathan came roaring back for Red Dead Redemption 2. But yeah, I will find like I'll be playing around and it'll be getting dark and I'll pull out my map and see how far am I from the camp. It's like, well, that's a long ride and this game does not have traditional fast travel in it. So what am I going to do? I guess I'm going to go over here because that ridge looks pretty good, and I'm going to set up a camp, and I'm going to groom my horse, and I'm going to roast some of the like meat I got today from some hunting, and I'm going to eat that, and then I'm going to sleep until morning, and then I'm going to pack up, and then I'm going to pick a new spot on the map and go to that. And as you say, when you get back to the camp, you greet people, and you go get some coffee, and you kind of just take care of yourself, and you change your clothes and all that, and you feel like such a part of a world that exists and evolves and goes on without you. It, like, that camp, those are people. Those are not vessels for things for you to do with, you know? Like, it's a very different feeling than most things like this in a game. And I really do think the entire, and this goes down to the story and the characters and everything too, but the entire setup of the Dutch Vanderlinde gang and what they have done to leverage that as a story and as an element of gameplay in this world where it is intrinsic to everything, that there's this camp that you go back to and you are working for and you are improving and you are, you know, contributing to and you are hanging out at. It's a magic trick. It is the biggest evolution Rockstar has taken since GTA 4. Probably further back than that. Probably since like GTA 3 and the introduction of the fucking compass system, you know? Like, It feels like a significant reorientation of how they leverage these amazing open worlds they build. And what it is like, you know, in GTA 5, I can tell you objectively, that's a really cool open world they built. That's a really cool version of California. It's an interesting version of Los Angeles. It looks good. It's fun to drive around and look at things. But do you feel like you're a part of it? Does it feel memorable and meaningful and impactful in the way the best open worlds do? No, I don't think so at all. And this one leapfrogs that by a million miles and a lot of open world games in the years since to say, no, there's a way we can really leverage these talents we have for building a giant open world and make it feel like a place that you inhabit, that it's three-dimensional in multiple meanings of that word. And I'm really impressed by that because that's what I wanted out of Red Dead 2. I wanted to feel like these very talented folks at Rockstar could, you know, put that talent to a real evolution of their craft. And I think they really have here. And I'm extremely impressed by that.
Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, I almost wish that there was like a hardcore mode or something that you could play that was like, it took out all the main story stuff and just was like, I would like, you know, made like the cores, like the health core and stamina core, like that stuff drain more severely and like, have hunger, like, so you have to deal with hunger and like make it like even a more hardcore cowboy sim that, and just like, because I am really enjoying the story and I'm happy to have the story go forward, but there are moments where I'm like, after I'm done with this story, like I kind of want to just have this like super hardcore cowboy sim in this world. Because like some of my favorite stuff that has happened is stuff that is, you know, obviously they've crafted these little scenarios that you encounter randomly, but they're not like the big missions that you start. It's like the weird little things that pop up in the open world. And one thing I'm so tremendously impressed by is just the sheer quantity so far of different random events that I've seen, because it is not the Red Dead Redemption 1 thing of where, you know, because it felt cool and novel at the time, but if you went back and tried to play that game at all in the past, like, 3 to 5 years, you'd notice that it's like, oh, you know, there's the woman that runs out and is like, help me, and then you stop, and then the gang jumps out and comes and attacks you. Or it's like there's like the impromptu hanging that happens on a tree somewhere. Like, it's a lot of those kinds of scenarios that there's like about a dozen of them, which was impressive at the time, but it got very repetitive. And like, again, when you go back to it seems excessively repetitive. And in Red Dead Redemption 2, I just feel like I keep on running into things that I sure are basically pretty handcrafted, because they have so much distinctive dialogue around them that like they had to record all this different stuff of like, I met a dude that I was in the kind of the bayou area, because I kind of was doing one of the side quests and I didn't even know there was a bayou area. And this was earlier today, and I was just like, oh fuck, there's like this whole weird Louisiana bit. And then I ran into a dude on the road who fell off his horse that got mauled by like an alligator, and I had to take him to the doctor. And so I rode into Saint Denis, I think it's called, which is basically in New Orleans. So I'm really excited to go see what eventually the story is going to take me there. But I just kind of ended up stumbling into there because of this random thing I found, and then took him to the doctor. And then the doctor had to amputate his arm. And if you run into this event, stick around, because he fucking, like, the doctor says, hey buddy, you probably don't want to see this. You should leave. But you don't have to leave. It doesn't, like, push you out and give you, like, a little cutscene where it forces you out and, like, closes the door. And maybe they recorded some audio lines of, like, a guy getting his arm cut off. Luckily, the guy was knocked out. This is 1899. It's not, like, 1830 or something. He was unconscious when the guy severed his arm or amputated it. But they fully, like, animated this full sequence of this doctor taking a fucking bone saw, amputating this dude's arm, like treating it, and then like just sort of leaning back there and saying like, oh, it was rough, but you're gonna pull through. And it was a whole sequence, and I just stood there and watched it, and like halfway through, Arthur Morgan just goes, holy shit, man. And it was that kind of weird magical experience of, you know, magical is maybe a weird word, but from like a game player point of view, it felt very magical, because it felt like this thing I stumbled upon that was so reactive to me and did not follow the basic laws and rules of game design and like a gameplay machinations that I have come to understand through my whole life of playing video games. And it like just kept going way past the point that I would expect some small side thing to go. This was not a spoke off of a main mission. This was not something that I felt like I was even supposed to see, because there was nothing really bringing me that far south at this point in the game. I just kind of stumbled upon it, and like that is now forever, that is what Saint Denis is to me. That is how Arthur Morgan first encountered the city, was randomly riding into it, desperately trying to find a doctor for this guy, and then riding the fuck out of that city, because it's like, I don't like the sound of the horse on the cobblestone. That it's weird and it's off-putting to me, and I like that was my introduction to like civilization in this game.
That's amazing. That has not happened to me yet. I have not been to Saint Denis. That is a great story, and now I'm going to be looking for the guy who's had his arm injured, because I want to see that fucking amputation sequence.
It blew my fucking mind that whole thing was animated. It's like, I just, like, no video game would ever do this. This is absurd. Like, holy shit. Okay, yeah, he's just cutting that dude's arm off and then throwing it in a bucket.
It's a thing. All right, should we talk a little bit about how we're playing this game? Because I've got stories to tell.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell me one of your stories.
All right. So I had not thought much about how I wanted to play this game, like, you know, being good or bad, or like, I mean, let's recap a little bit. For people who are not longtime listeners of the Weekly Stuff podcast, this podcast does not date back quite to the release of Red Dead 1, but close enough that we've told a lot of stories about it. The most famous one is that, Sean, you like to prank me, or not prank me, mock me for never having bought the bandolier when I played Red Dead 1. Do you want to recap that story for the listeners?
Yeah, let's make it more clear. Well, yeah, let's do the whole story, and then I'll make it more clear what the whole scenario was, where it was, because the thing was that you got to Red Dead Redemption a little late.
It was like late 2010, yeah.
Yes, and but because I remember you were playing it in the condo, and yeah. So you had not played the game like immediately upon its release.
Might have been 2011 then. Weird.
Yeah. And later. No. The game came out in 2011, so it was 7 years ago.
Okay.
And then, so then you got to it like later that year because we were in the condo. And it was like early on, us in the condo, very early on. And we talk about this whole story in our original top 10 video games thing is one of the times it popped up because I re-listened to it before we did our revised version of it. And so what happened was you were basically right near the end of the game, because that was one of the reasons why I was watching you is because I wanted to see the end of the game again.
I was playing Jack Morgan at this point.
Yeah. Marston. And so, and you were just riding around being evil because you're evil in that game and just like murdering people willy-nilly, stabbing people. And it's not just murder in the way of like shooting people in the faces. Like you were like weirdly creative with your murder.
The thing
and,
I would
like,
do
piling
is,
bodies up and shit.
Is I would go into Blackwater and I would hogtie a woman with my lasso. And then I would kidnap the woman out of town, kill all the cops that were after me. And then I'd go into the church and throw the person on the altar of the church and stab them like I was doing a dark blood ritual.
Yeah, this is like the full role-playing experience for Jonathan Lack.
Yes.
So I was just watching all of this, and then obviously when you're committing your dark sacrifices in the middle of like the most populated section of the town, they start sending the law after you, and so you're getting into these big running gunfights where you're constantly running out of ammo. And I just had this experience of watching this video, like, well, how the fuck is Jonathan running out of ammo constantly in this game? He's not using any of the good guns. I don't know why he's not using, like, the fucking repeater rifle that holds, like, 22 shots or the revolver that has 9 shots in it or whatever. You're just using all, like very basic weapons and then running out of ammo because I almost never ran out of ammo. And then I noticed that your character model looked a little bit weird. And then I realized, oh, it's because you never bought the fucking bandolier, which is an item in Red Dead Redemption 1 that is available from the first time you enter Armadillo, the first town of that game. And you go to the gun store, and there's a bandolier item that you can purchase for what I remember is relatively cheap, that doubles your ammo capacity for every single weapon in the game. And so, like, effectively, like, I played the whole game with 2 times the amount of ammo that you did, Jonathan, and it blew my mind that you would have never bought the bandolier. And it was only then later that I discovered that you had never bought the bandolier. You didn't know that you could buy items in the game at all. You thought the shops only existed so you could rob them. You had never even tried to fucking buy anything from them. And it's ridiculous.
This is true. This is all true. And Sean, I'll say one thing. I have bought the bandolier in Red Dead 2. It was the first thing I bought with my own money. I went into the gun store and I paid my money. Much of it ill-gotten for reasons I'll tell you soon. And I bought that fucking bandolier. It's a little different. It's a bandolier upgrade in this one. But I did get it. And so I am good on ammo. I have also bought a few weapons. But I still mostly use the stores for robbing. So when you said you can buy clothes from the general store, I had no idea that was a thing in this game. I didn't know you could buy clothes. That's amazing. I can't wait to go buy some clothes and then rob the person who runs the general store. I have robbed him 3 times, so I hope he still allows me to buy things.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are there more dark murders? Have you gone down that path, or is it mostly just robbing people of their hard-earned cash?
Okay, well, one of the first things I did try when I got to Valentine is going into the church, and you cannot go into that church. I don't know about the one in Blackwater, if I can still do my... Because, like, the map of Red Dead 1 is in this game. Mm-hmm. Like, Mexico is not there, I don't think. But New Austin and stuff. And I've been to Blackwater a little tiny bit. Like, I've seen it. And it was like, holy crap, that's Blackwater, but it looks like a 2018 video game now, you know? But anyway, yeah. But here's... So, Sean, the way Red Dead Redemption 2 opens is Chapter 1 is sort of like a prologue. It's very on rails. You're in the mountains in the winter. I think it's a great opening to the game. Very well done and, like, slow in the right ways for this kind of game. But then you get to Chapter 2, and you've set up camp near Valentine, and that's when the game opens up and allows you to go out on your own. So I did that, and the first thing was, all right, there's this town, Valentine. I want to go find my way to Valentine. I need to figure out the horse controls, because at this point I had not figured all that out, and I'm going to make my way to Valentine. And I get out into the world, Sean, and I realize, oh, this is a Red Dead Redemption game. And some of my instincts just kind of, like, just kicked in. And the first, I've got to remember if this is the first or second, I'll tell it how I kind of remember it. I don't know the exact order. The first thing I did was I went up and tried to talk to a stranger on horseback. And I saw that you could rob the person. So I pulled out my gun and tried to rob him. But the thing is, some people will fight back. So he started shooting at me, so I blew his head off. And I had a dead body there. And then it said, witness. And I'm like, oh shit. And someone had seen me do it. And so I ran after him, shot him. But then another person had seen the first body. And so I had to run back there, shoot him. But then another... Anyway, this ended with me committing 5 homicides before I was finally in the clear. And I had killed a lot of people, but I did not have like a bounty on me yet. So I'd killed all these people. I'm like, okay. But I got some money. I got like $5 from all that. And so I go into Valentine. And I'm walking around like, this is kind of interesting. And I go into the gun shop, and I think I'm intending to buy the bandolier because your voice was ringing in my head. Buy the bandolier, Jonathan. And I did not have enough money for the bandolier yet, so I thought, can I rob these people? And I could. So I tried to rob the gun store owner, but the gun store owner will fight back. He will pull a gun out because he is the gun store owner.
He owns the fucking gun store. Yes. Of course he's going to fucking pull on you.
So I had to blow his head off, which is bad. The gun store owner is across from the sheriff, and then I killed the sheriff. And anyway... I killed a whole lot of people on my way out, and I had a $200 bounty right off the bat in this game, and I'm fucked because, like, I only had $40 at this point. I was trying to, like, I didn't want to immediately be, like, doing the dishonorable route in this game. I just was trying to, like, play the game, and it all went wrong. It went horribly wrong. A life of crime is bad, and I learned why here, and finally I go back in, and I'm trying to figure things out. And I surrender to the sheriff, which wipes out my bounty. I spend a few nights in jail. I lose all of my money, but I'm able to, like, make a fresh start. And I was sort of depressed. But then, you know, I got better at committing crimes. So, you know, I realized you can put on your mask when you go to, like, rob the general store owner. And then if you go out the back and get on your horse and just run away, they're never going to know. So that's how I do it now when I need an extra $30. And then at some point in here... I forget where this happened, but this was also very early on, like before I started doing missions, is a train went by and I jumped on the train. And before I knew it, I had killed a bunch of people on the train and hijacked the train. And when you hijack the train, that's a huge bounty they put on you. And it does not go away while you're on the train because you can like drive the train yourself. And I'm driving the train around and I've got all these lawmen on me. And I get off the train and kill a bunch of them and then ride into town. And at this point, I had another $200 bounty. Anyway, it all went kind of crazy. And I'm pretty near the bottom of the, there's the red to white, like, honor, dishonor meter. I'm pretty near the bottom red. I've been playing fairly dishonorably. I hate to say, and some of this is because sometimes the controls get confusing and I accidentally fire when I mean to aim because L2 and R2 and all that, they do different things in different contextual circumstances. There have been several strangers where I've wanted to see what their story is and I accidentally shot them in the head while trying to get their money. So, you know, I've gone a little bit crazy at different points in Red Dead Redemption 2. I have not yet hogtied anyone to train tracks or sacrificed them on an altar yet.
Okay.
But that's coming.
That's good to know. So let me tell you a little bit about how I'm playing the game to contrast the way that you're playing the game. I like that we're getting the full spectrum of the experience here because I'm not as... strictly honorable as I was as John Marston because in Red Dead Redemption 1 because Arthur Morgan does not feel like he's the best dude in the world. Even if you play him honorably, like he's pretty rough and tumble a lot more than John ever was. But the thing that and so for a long time I was actually struggling with like how honorable should I play the character and like kind of like trying to work it in my head because I like the whole role playing aspect of it. And where I've kind of landed with him is he's definitely like you push him a little bit too hard and he will fuck you up. And I have done some crimes on people that I felt like are assholes and kind of deserve it. Like I'm not just like wantonly murdering people in town. I haven't robbed any stores or any trains yet. I'll definitely get there at some point just to see it. But yeah, I've mostly been like random assholes out on in the wilds or something where I know there's not going to be any witnesses. I've done a little bit. But other than that, the main thing like where I've kind of landed with the character is he's honorable most of the time. And the reason I feel that is like, because Arthur Morgan's not an idiot. And what separates him from the other people in the gang, like Bill Williamson and Micah, where like most of the people in the gang are idiots and murderers, and like, you know, Bill Williamson and Micah are bad fucking people and you don't want to deal with them. Like right now one of my missions is to go rescue Micah from prison because he murdered some dude in some town. I haven't done that one yet. Because it's like, let him rot for a little bit. I'll spend a couple of days getting to you, Micah, because you fucking suck.
I have a story about that one. We'll get to it.
Okay, yeah. But so for my Arthur, I really like sort of trying to find ways to resolve confrontations that in ways that do not spiral out into mass murder, because it feels like that's what he would do, especially at this moment in the game where he's like, we're trying to keep a low profile. I'm trying to keep it quiet. Like Arthur Morgan's not an idiot, even if he's not a deeply moral person most of the time. But he has his code. So that's kind of how I've been playing him. One thing that is very important to me is the cowboy dress up. Jonathan, you have no idea what you've been missing out on, because there are so many clothes in this fucking game. It is fashion game I've ever seen, because it's just, there's so much, and you can put on shirts and vests, and you can put like fucking jeans on, and then put what the fuck, like chaps, you know, leather chaps on over the jeans that are different colors if you want, and you have all kinds of different boots and different hats. Like I even, you know, I had one scenario where in the middle of a gunfight, my hat got shot off in a really great way of like right when I was getting into cover, the bullet came and whizzed by and just took my hat off and I like popped up immediately and shot that dude in the face. But afterwards, I was looking around and couldn't find which one was my hat because there were a lot of hats, because there were a lot of dead bodies at the end of that. It was a mission, so I was just randomly murdering people, but there are a lot of dead bodies at the end of that mission. So then I used that as an opportunity to be like, oh, I'm just going to go right into town with a hatless Arthur Morgan, which was a fun experience. I did actually a mission as a hatless Arthur Morgan because I was right by it, and that was a whole different experience. And then I bought a new hat. I've been wearing that hat for now. And so that's a whole thing I love, just the... they have really fleshed out if you want to play cowboy dress up and if you want to have your big long, you know, duster jacket, you can. If you want to have no jacket and just rock that kind of vest look, that's pretty cool. I also love the way that his hair and facial hair grow kind of in real time. And I love that you don't... It is a thing I've always wanted a video game to do, just because I was curious what it would be like, is to do that thing of, oh, because I've seen other video games like The Witcher where your hair, like facial hair grows over the course of the game. Other games have done that, but I've never seen a game dictate what kind of hairstyles and things you can do based on the length of hair, and that you cannot magically grow hair and you cannot magically grow a beard. So it's like, if you want to go to the barber or whatever and get like a different hairstyle that requires really long hair, you just have to spend time in the game and like sleep a bunch of days away or go do other stuff. And then eventually you go to get that taken care of. If you want to grow a wicked mustache, you have to fucking grow a wicked mustache.
I do love the hair, and I keep like seeing the shave option and looking at it and being like, I love the fucking like raggedy beard my Arthur Morgan has. I'm not cutting this. It looks too cool. I have not shaved yet.
I was an unshaven Arthur Morgan for a while, and then eventually I decided I'm going to check what like the shaved Arthur Morgan looks like, and I kind of like him a little bit more. At some point, I'm going to just have to get the level 10 beard just to see what it is. But I like a little bit of scruff, but not my, like, and I like seeing the like beard grow, like him being kind of clean shaven looking. Although clean shaven is not like clean shaven, you know, it's not like modern.
It's 1899 clean shaven.
Yeah, exactly. So it's scruffy no matter what you do. But yeah, so I love all that. I love all that dress up stuff. That's a big part of how I play the game. But then the other thing I like, other moments I've really loved are like the kind of random things I encounter where I get to be a good person. Because I imagine, Jonathan, well, now you're going to go take the guy to the doctor. But if I had not told that story, you would have just fucking shot that dude in the middle of the road and taken all his money.
I keep telling myself I'm going to rob less people. I'm going to rob fewer people in the game. And I keep being bad at it, because every once in a while I'll be running along and I'll be like, I'm going to be good today. And then I see someone in a kind of fancy carriage and I think he's probably got like $3 on him. I could use those $3. And I rob the guy and then he pulls out a gun and I kill him. And then his wife is getting out. I'm like, well, I can't leave her alive. She's a witness. So I kill her and then I take the wagon and I can sell the wagon. So that's nice. But then three other people saw me and I have to kill. Anyway, it all spirals. Once you start a life of crime, it's like Pringles. Once you pop a head, you just can't stop popping heads.
Yeah, I guess that maybe I'm good for not digging into that life. I will say that I think I like how much of a money pressure is in the game because there's so much to buy and so much of it is so expensive that it feels like I have this real temptation to go and just rob a bunch of people, even though I know if you fuck up, it's going to cost you money because you have to pay the bounties and all that stuff. But there's like a, like, I really need some money, and I haven't given it that temptation much yet. The one moment that is probably my favorite moment I've had in the whole game was one where I got to play like what felt like the right moral thing for Arthur Morgan of like, I'm doing the right thing, but I'm not a good guy kind of situation. Was I was riding, I think I was on my way back to camp, and it was like in the middle of the night, and riding through this one like kind of like pass where, you know, it wasn't like a full valley, but it kind of like was like a little road that kind of like cut through a hill. So it had this like nice kind of pass feel to it. And then in the off the side of the road to the left, there was a carriage, and the driver of the carriage was dead, very violently dead. And there was another dead woman on the ground, and there was an unseemly looking fellow checking out that corpse, and clearly this guy had murdered these people and was like robbing their bodies, which is not cool. And that carriage seemed like it was like, again, like a total normal family that was just riding that carriage, not like the cops or anything, and this guy murdered them. And so I slow my horse, you know, down to a trot and hop off and saunter over, because, you know, Arthur Morgan has a great walk animation, and just kind of saunter over with my, you know, you can, one thing that's really important is you have to put spurs on your boots. You have separately equipable spurs.
I do not know
that's this. How good the cowboy dress up is in this game. You can customize the spurs you fucking want. And so my spurs are jangling, and I walk over to the guy, and he kind of looks up, and first I do the left trigger thing, and this is like the magic of Red Dead Redemption 2, is that you can really like play this whole scenario out, as I do the left trigger thing and do the first like disarm scenario, whatever it is, of like try to like kind of assess the situation to maybe calm him down a little bit, and Arthur Morgan just goes, "What are you doing down here?" And then the guy sort of just like, "Hey man, it's not what it looks like. Just ride, get on your horse and ride away. Like, we don't need anything here between us." And I kind of eye the guy for a second, and I'm playing the calculus in my head of like, do I want to, and because this was still when I was trying to figure out where Arthur Morgan is on the spectrum, and I think this kind of sealed the kind of vaguely noble cowpoke thing I wanted to go for with him, was like sort of standing there in a little bit of a stare down, and then I do the left trigger again and do like the threaten or whatever option, and like to make it aggressive, and I forget what Arthur Morgan says, but he says something to him of like, "I'm sorry, but I'm gonna have to put you down, boy." And then, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2 has the thing that every good video game has, which is it has a holster or unholster weapon button. So it's
the best button.
Yes, it's the best button in every game that has it. I always love it. So you press L1, pull my gun, and then if you can basically fire from the hip in the game by not aiming and just hammering on R2. And so I just pull the gun and hammer on R2 and just bop, 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 and do the whole, like, you know, slam your hand, like your left hand on the hammer of the revolver to fire it really quick. And I fire just 6 shots right in this dude's chest before he's even able to draw his gun. And he falls backwards to the ground in a pile of blood. And I slowly reload my shots as I saunter back up to the guy, slam the gun back into my holster, pick up his body, rob the body, whistle my horse over, hop on the horse, and ride back to camp, all like into the moonlight. And it felt like the coolest fucking, like it would have been the best 15-minute opening to a cowboy movie ever, you know? And it just, being able to express all that naturally in gameplay and having the game feel like it is responsive and reactive to that in a way that in Red Dead Redemption 1, you can have scenarios that are kind of like that, but you have to really use your imagination to kind of like flesh it out if you really want to kind of have that experience. Whereas Red Dead Redemption 2, it feels like I don't need to imagine anything about the scenario. Like, this whole scenario is what the scenario is, and you know, that just being able to, with the controls, unholster my gun, fire it from the hip, like not even having to do the whole, like, you know, dual mini game that the last one and this one has. It felt like this was like the, you know, Han shot first kind of moment, and just being able to do that, it was so fucking cool.
I would be really curious what would have happened if you had hogtied the guy and brought him to the sheriff. Because I have a story, which is that I was out in the field one day, and I was running around, and I hear some guy going like, "Hey, mister, can you help me?" And I'm looking around like, what the? And I see in the bushes, there's this dude kind of crouching and hiding. So I walk over to him and greet him, and he's in like striped pajamas because he's a, not striped pajamas, but whatever you call them. He's in a prison uniform, you know? And he's got his, you know, his arms are in handcuffs. And he says, "Hey, if you free me from these cuffs, I'll give you something good," or something, you know? And I had the option, I could shoot the cuffs off, but I thought like, because I'd been doing it at this point, I'd done some bounty work for the sheriff, and those are really fun missions. And yeah. they're a little different than in like Red Dead 1 or in other games like this. There's a little more variability to them. But anyway, and I thought, well, this guy's an escaped convict. I wonder what will happen here. So I pulled out my lasso, and I hogtied him and brought him back into town. Got $15 for that. The dude was expecting him, the sheriff. He was like, "Very thankful, Mr. Morgan." And I was like, this is interesting. So
fuck.
Yeah.
It had never even occurred to me that I could have hogtied that guy and brought him back to the sheriff.
They would have accounted for it. Like, that's how, like, if you push on this game, it pushes back. It has something for you, you know? But by this token, Sean, I've done lots of moral things in the game. I did that thing with the prisoner, and then probably the most moral thing I did in the game so far is while I was out on one bounty. When you do the bounties, like, it sends you to a place, and it's got, like, a circle, and, like, within this area is the prisoner, right? Or the bounty. Mm-hmm. And while I was looking for that person, I was on the road. I'd just kind of gotten off my horse, and I'm walking around, and I had my double-barreled shotgun out because it's my favorite gun. And I was kind of wandering around looking for this person because it had told me, like, she's going to be with a group. So, like, I had to be ready to fire. And these two guys come coming down the road on horseback, and they've both got their guns out. And they're not quite firing on me, but they're like, you know, "Get out of the way." And I'm like, "Oh God, what's going to happen here?" And I aim at them because I'm like, "What are they up to?" And they start firing. So finally, I'm like, "Well, fuck, fuck." And I shoot them both, and I've killed everyone. And I realize one of them has a guy on the back of their horse. These guys were bounty hunters, and this was their bounty, and they'd been taking him, and we just got into this skirmish, and I killed them. So I'm like, "Eh, fuck it." And I took the guy, and I got him off of their horse, put him on my horse, took him into town, got $20 for that. It was a bounty.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of bounty hunters ride by, and I've just kind of let them be, because I was like, it feels especially immoral to fight bounty hunters when I myself have been playing the bounty game.
Yes.
You know, I'm a pseudo-lawman myself when I need to be.
But again, I love that you can do that, because again, these are the kind of scenarios where, like, you can get creative in how you're going to approach things, and the game will have something for you. That's part of what makes it so, like, crazy to play and experience, and it really does feel like kind of the nth degree expression of the whole Rockstar open world design philosophy, you know?
Yeah. One other detail that I love about this game that you reminded me of when you said the double-barreled shotgun it's a fucking great weapon. It was one of the best weapons in Red Dead Redemption 1. It's great in this one also. But it's more the whole weapon system in this game I just love, because you never played Max Payne 3, did you, Jonathan?
No.
No. Okay, so Max Payne 3 was a game that came out, I think, 2012, 2011. It was like one of those like late era 360 PS3 games that Rockstar sort of developed. But I think it was like one of those weird ones, kind of like L.A. Noire, that was kind of Rockstar developed, kind of not, but they definitely published it. And in that game, they had a really awesome weapon system, which was you could have two single-handed weapons and one long weapon. And you would switch between them, so you could have like one pistol out, or two pistols out, or your rifle out. Or you could do a thing that I loved, that now Red Dead Redemption 2 finally has brought this back, and I just think it's the coolest fucking thing in the world, is you put your long weapon and hold it in your left hand, like from the barrel, and just like kind of hold it there, and you can pull out your like pistol. And you can just do this thing of, if you're firing your double-barreled shotgun and you fire both shells really quickly and you need like more firepower but can't take the time to reload, you can very quickly switch to your pistol and pull your pistol out while holding the shotgun in the left hand and fire a pistol with your right hand. And the way that animation works and feels so physically real, it's one of those things, like I talked about this a lot with Hitman and your ability to put guns down in the environment in Hitman. It's one of those details that makes the gun feel like a physical object in the world, along with being able to holster and unholster it, that makes it not feel just like it's just this like weird bit like bolted onto your character's arm and it's like the separate physical object. Because also, if you're like, you know, I just did a cool quest that was the last thing I've done in the game, where I rode back up into the sort of snowy mountain area to go talk to one of the gunslingers, that there's a whole stranger's side quest about going and finding four gunslingers for this book that this guy's writing. And one of them is up in the snowy mountain pass, And I went up there, and shit kind of pops off with his gang, and I shoot up his gang with my carbine rifle, and then the guy is hiding out in the like this little like kind of shitty little cabin thing, and he's kind of like he's in there like with the door barred, and I walk up, and like I don't even have my gun ready because that's like how confident my Arthur Morgan is if you press L1, which is the holster unholster weapon, when you have your long gun out, he just does that thing of where he just carries it kind of casually in his left hand, not even with the finger on the trigger, and just saunter up with it like that. It's the most like sort of like badass, just like you can't do anything to me, boy. Like I'm gonna smack you down so hard, kind of move. That again, it's there's so many little details like that built into the game that feels so incredibly expressive to me, and that's kind of the term and the concept I keep on coming back to this game is expression and being able to express myself in this role playing kind of sense in the game. And it's not the game is not like demanding that I do this, but it's the kind of thing I've always done in these kinds of games, and it's giving me so much space to do it in. And then it is, like you were saying, it is also pushing back against me and giving me feedback and giving me these scenarios that are so reactive to what I am expressing. And that's the kind of thing that just makes these moments that are so magical that lots of games have once or twice, that I feel like Red Dead Redemption 2 has like once an hour, you know, yes, or once every 30 minutes.
It's a game that like rewards imagination and playing slowly and exploring and thinking about the game and how you interact with it in really cool ways. And while we're talking about guns and holstering, I fucking love the sound effects of holstering and unholstering a gun in this game, whether it is on your back, on your hip, from the horse. I love the whole system where your horse carries stuff, and like you can like when you get off your horse, like choose like I'm going to take this with me, but like my horse will have more of it. It's a much better system than in Red Dead 1, where you just had every gun under the sun with you at all times, and it actually became more confusing than I think was necessary because of that. But I just love like the sound. I can hear it in my head right now of pulling that double-barreled shotgun out, and just the way it like you can hear the metal and the wood like kind of crinkling and turning, and just it's so cool. It's not even like the sounds of the guns firing, which is also very good. It's the sound of just like holding one and cleaning it and like unholstering it, holstering it. It's just the meatiest, coolest sound effects. I mean, you can apply that to pretty much any section of the game. It's ludicrously polished, because everyone worked 100-hour weeks. We'll talk about that later. But, man, it's good.
Yeah, another thing in that regard that I just really like is the, like, you pull the trigger to do, like, to cycle the lever on the carbine rifle or to pull back the hammer on a revolver. That's, like, it took me a while to get used to it because no fucking video game has ever done something like that before. And so I kept on, like, firing way too many shots when I was trying to...
I still do that.
Yeah, and trying to cycle it and stuff. But now that I've, like, sort of trained myself as, like, no, that's how the shooting in Red Dead Redemption 2 is, you're able to do some really fun stuff with that. That is, like, kind of, like, dumb movie thing of, like, you know, I don't have... I know there's a pump-action shotgun. There has to be somewhere later in the game. I'm excited to get it. But, you know, it's that kind of, like, pump-action shotgun fucking Terminator 2 kind of thing of, you know, I'm just going to pump the shotgun, even though it doesn't make sense logically. It's like, why wouldn't you have just pumped that immediately after firing that last shot? All that kind of stuff. It's like, or you haven't even fired anything yet. You just shot a fucking shotgun shell out of the side of this gun for no reason. But it gives you that little extra sort of mechanical control over the machine of the gun. And the moment that felt like this was really properly like fucking cool and like a really worthy addition was when, you know, occasionally when you're in a gunfight, it will do that kind of like cinematic cutaway thing of like zoom in on the guy you just shot and like the face or whatever, and then it'll usually cut back to Arthur. And I've now trained myself to, when that happens, of when I see that thing trigger, I don't cycle the gun yet. I wait, and so when it cuts back to Arthur, that's when I cycle the lever on the carbine or pull back the hammer on the revolver again, because it just adds that little extra like fuck you-ness to it. You know, this just having, again, it's expressiveness. It's just being able to say, I'm so confident that I've just won this gunfight that you are on the ground that I'm not even going to, like, reload my gun, basically, or recycle the chamber yet because you're on the ground and I'm not going to do it until I'm right up on top of you because I'm a badass cowboy man.
It's Yes, there's a lot here. All right. So let's talk a little bit about story and presentation elements. I think we should move on soon, so maybe another like 10, 15 minutes. But let's talk a little bit about story and presentation. Like, I don't know how much more we want to say, because, you know, you would get into, like, not spoiler territory, but we're going to save a lot of this for a fuller story discussion somewhere down the line. I am, though, impressed so much with the writing in this game and the characterization. I think it's all of, like, the best Rockstar stuff from the past, of, like, their voice for making very vivid characters and for just how different people talk and time and place and those sorts of things. And I feel like they've left a lot of the, like, nihilism and the, like, sophomoric stuff they would do in other games behind. And they've really focused on taking that core of what they do well, adding nuance to it, making these characters feel so human, having a writing style that is, I mean, it just crackles. It's like Elmore Leonard or something. You just love hearing these people talk and looking at the words coming out of their mouth. And at the same time, it feels like it is grappling with some really heavy thematic stuff in this prequel vein of, you are playing as a gang you know is going to dissolve sooner rather than later because of the events of Red Dead 1. And you're, like, inhabiting a dying world and a dying way of life. And the game is so, you know, elegiac for all of that in really interesting, smart ways. I think it's thinking about the morality of these characters in interesting ways, where it's not saying, fuck it, there is no real morality to the world, so let's all be criminals. But it's also not saying, like, you know, there's a god that's going to damn all of these people, and being very, didactic in that way. It paints those shades of gray so well, and it does just feel mature to a degree that, like, in terms of a sustained thing, I don't think I've seen Rockstar do before. Like, again, there's parts of Red Dead 1 that absolutely go for this, and those are the ones we all remember, like the stuff on Bonnie's ranch and when John Marston dies and when he's hanging out with his son. But you forget the, like, long stretches of Red Dead 1 where you're palling around with all these fucking weirdos and you're dealing with, like, the Mexican Civil War, and it doesn't quite feel like it knows what it wants to say about any of that, and it goes on and on, and we've all forgotten about those parts, rightly. This feels like a sustained version of the best parts of Rockstar's past and then taken to a new level.
Yeah, I completely agree. A lot of it feels like it's Rockstar with restraint, you know? They don't need to, you know, you get to have, like, fun conversations with, you know, Hosea or whoever when you're, like, riding with him to a mission, and you still have those conversations that were always fun to have in Rockstar games before, but they would always end up devolving, and, like, Red Dead, like, had it a lot, and, like, I can, like, very distinctly just hear, like, John Marston's voice in my head just, like kind of spitting out, like, the beliefs of, like, the writers and like, they're, like, just sort of, like, espousing stuff on the state of the West and America and some of it being pseudo-satirical, but, like, you know, John, it was the straight man in that game, and everybody else was, as you say, kind of, with some exceptions, like Bonnie McFarlane or, like, some of the stuff near the end of the game, everybody else was, like, very zany and kind of over the top. And so John was the straight man next to all of them and, like, told it like it was and had this very sort of, like, prosaic, weird fucking thing about him when that game got very unnatural. And this game feels natural all the time. And it feels like people do not suddenly become mouthpieces for, you know, the writer or for whatever in that moment. There are always people expressing themselves, expressing, like, their opinions, their place in life. I just had a scene earlier today that you probably have had that's just, like, a conversation you can have in camp with, I think it's Mary Beth, it's one of the women, and it's just a conversation that Arthur can have with her where he sits down and she just says, like, hey, like, you look, like, stressed out or something or sad, like, do you want to talk about something? And he very slowly expresses his feelings and tries to articulate himself about this feeling of we are part of a dying breed, you know, like the end of the West thing that, like, every Western movie does. But the way he does it, while it's the kind of thing that, you know, Rockstar had written a bunch in Red Dead Redemption 1, the way he says it feels so much more natural to his character and doesn't feel like he's being a mouthpiece. There are all these moments where he has to really stop and he kind of sighs and thinks for a second and then expresses something. And it's one of the things that, one of those moments that really helped me articulate my vision of the Arthur Morgan character is that, like, he does have a lot more morality and a lot more of a soul hidden underneath all that stuff, which is kind of, you know, a cliche characterization for a cowboy, but the way they go about it feels Like, you have to, you really have to dig for it. But you have those moments like, I didn't even realize this, and I don't know if you've even seen this yet, Jonathan, because it's kind of hidden down there, where you can go and you can read his journal.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, and that was a moment, you know, when I first realized that, of like, oh my god, like, there's this, you know, there are, must be fucking dozens, if not hundreds, of journal entries for this fucking guy in this game. I have no idea how long this game is and how many of those there could be, but they are... like, they're relatively short, but they're really well written, and they give you like this insight into how he is seeing the things around him, and that in his writing he is able to be so much more articulate and able to express and explore things and explain things about himself and to himself in his writing that he's not able to in speaking to other characters, other than in those little tiny moments like the conversation he has with Mary Beth or whatever her name is. And that's where that writing really shines for me, is that the characters feel very honest to themselves, and they are restrained and sort of like, a lot of the male characters in particular are really kind of bottled up, but in a way that feels appropriate and right, and they have found much more natural ways to explore that space without those characters just blowing up and like spouting speeches off for like a 10-minute horse ride. Because also Red Dead Redemption 2 very mercifully cuts the horse rides down when like you need to. It's like, okay, we can just do kind of a little bit of cinematic montage to get you where you're going after we've had all the talk. And so they don't have to write an hour-long speech if you're driving or riding a horse all the way across the fucking game world. They don't have to write a speech that takes up all that time. They can write whatever they need to and then cut from there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I always in Rockstar games get to a point of is when I have to go activate a mission, I just kind of dread it, because I'm going to have to watch a long, preachy cutscene, and then I'm going to have to go on a long, preachy car and or horse ride, you know, whatever it is. I guess not and or horse ride. There has not been a GTA / Red Dead yet. Although I would love if in GTA 6 you could just ride a horse around, you know, Liberty City or something. That'd be great. They should totally do that. Anyway, but in this game, when I go to activate a cutscene or go on a horse ride with people, I'm excited because I think the dialogue is so interesting and what they have to say is so interesting. And I know they're not going to overdo it, as you just said. Like, they're not going to force it on us if it's not needed there, if it is not necessary. And I think I'm so impressed by that. That, like, I am maybe for the first time in a Rockstar game, genuinely, like, my first priority is with the story and the characters. And part of that is just how much the characters are baked into the entire world, where even if you're not progressing the story through missions, you are interacting with the characters in significant ways. That is not something you could say about other Rockstar games. It's just not how they're built. It's not how most games are built. But it is that, like, Shenmue quality or Persona quality you're talking about, where it's just, it's all so baked in. I do love all of that. It really does feel like an evolution. There's a lot of game to go yet. You know, I want to be cautious here, but, like, it's really interesting. And part of that is Arthur Morgan is a great fucking character. Like, if anything, if I have any disagreement with the reviews that have come out so far, it might primarily be people saying, like, oh, Arthur Morgan, he's a little duller than other Rockstar protagonists. I'm like, no, he is, and that's a good thing. Like, he feels like a human being. Like, John Marston did too, to an extent, and in his best moments, John Marston's a great character, but I feel like Arthur Morgan is, one, it's just a great performance. The actor's name is Roger Clark, and it is just a magnificent vocal performance that he delivers. But on top of that, it's the way he's written as this guy who, he has lived this life, he has made his bed, he's not going to change, he is pretty sure of who he is and his role in this world. What he's not sure of is how the world's changing around him, you know, and what his place is going to be in this world. And I think it's a really, again, it's maybe a stock Western character, but it's just done so well, and it feels so in the moment. It does not feel like a character writing to us from the past or the future. It's a character who knows what he knows in the moment. And I love being this character. I love going around as him. I love learning more about him. I feel a sense of, like, you know, oneness with this character because of all the cowboy dress-up things, as you're talking about, but also he's just a really interesting figure, and I think part of it is that he's neither, like, the straight man or the zany person. He's not a complete downer like a Nico Bellic. He's not off the walls like Trevor in GTA 5, and he's not sort of this very sort of stoic figure like John Marston. He's much more human in shades of gray, and I think as a protagonist in this kind of game, he's exactly what you want. He's like Geralt-esque in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I 100% agree. He's Geralt-esque in both his characterization and in his quality of, like, I think you intimated this earlier, of, like, I could just listen to this dude, like, mumble about, oh, there's a deer that just ran through this brush. Like, just, like, whatever random shit he wants to mumble about to himself, I'm fucking here for it.
Oh, yes. It's Jeff Bridges with a couple fewer marbles in his mouth.
Yes, yeah. It's great. I also do love the, so far, you know, again, like, we're both very early, and I'm even earlier than you in terms of the main story stuff. But I like the integration of John Marston so far.
It's very well done.
Yeah, because I think they don't... I like that they both have not, like, they have not done a huge amount with it, but they're also not super coy with him. And I like that he's just there in the camp, because I thought that they would find some excuse to, like, have him be absent for most of the game, and then there's, like, this big, oh my god, there's John Marston, and, like, make this big kind of prequel-y deal about it. And instead, it's like, nope, he's there, he's a member of the game, and he kind of sucks. Like, I love that Arthur Morgan is just not having it with John, and it's just like, no, and the little hints you get about the backstory of that John left the gang for about a year at some point in the past after he had Jack. It's like, kind of fuck you, John Marston. And this quiet tragedy of knowing, you know, how all this is going to play out, knowing that the gang is going to fall apart, knowing that eventually John is going to get suckered in by the feds and have to hunt down everybody else and kill, you know, Bill Williamson and Dutch and everybody that's I guess still alive at that point, and then gets killed himself. Spoilers for Red Dead Redemption 1, but it's been a while.
It's like one of the single most famous moments in video game history. I think we can spoil it.
Yeah, if you have not had that spoiled for you somehow up to this point, I'm sorry, but also that's very impressive.
Master Chief dies and does not die at the end of Halo 3, and in Call of Duty 4 you get nuked and die. Just let's put it all out on the table.
Yeah, that way we never have to worry about talking around spoilers for those ever again.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it's the quiet tragedy of knowing where all of this is going and being at that moment before it. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't mind that sort of, like, prequel tragedy thing. It doesn't sort of, like, really dig into it and shove your face into it. I'm sure it's going to be a bit more obvious about it at later points in the story where it's more sort of pertinent. But there's just this, so far where I'm at, there's this quiet sense of, like, every time I go into town and see John and, like, think about some of that stuff and, like think about Dutch and where he is, I remember from the end of the last game and all that. It is this moment of being, of, like, I'm with Arthur, because, like, Arthur clearly senses that, like, obviously he doesn't know specifically what's going to happen, but he has this general sense of that's how things are eventually going to have to go down, and that's very sad, and, like, I feel sad about it with him, and that's, like, it's exploring a kind of emotional space that Rockstar games have never really done for me before. The closest was, like, maybe GTA 4 had a little bit of that, just, like, very quiet emotional depression and like emotional downness to it in the background, but even that was, like, you know, would have long like stretches with very wacky, zany bullshit satire kind of stuff, and it was only in little tiny moments where they'd kind of peek at that. And this game is like all that all the time.
Yes, it's extremely well done. I think they've handled John Marston perfectly, which, as you say, he's there, he's part of the game. They're not going too far with it, but they're also not underselling it. Like, they're not being coy about it. And I think, again, what makes this so good as a prequel is that it lives in its own moment. It does not feel like it is written from the perspective of, all these things are going to happen, let's check all the boxes. You know? It feels like this is the story that happened earlier, and we're just living in that time. And it's a subtle difference, but it makes all the difference in the world to me. You know, like, the clearest prequelization they've done is that John Marston gets the injury that causes his scars early on. But to me, like, that's just a good way to introduce him, because without those, he's unrecognizable, you know? So it's like, it's a smart way to get into the character. But after that, there's not, like, Arthur says, man, I'd love to own a ranch one day, John, and it'd suck if the feds came and tried to kill me and my boy. You know what I think I'd do, John? I think I'd send boy and his mother off, and I'd make one last stand. Wouldn't that sound good? They don't do that. Yeah. And I could see, I was worried they might do that. You know, when I heard, oh, prequel, Rockstar is not a subtle storytelling agency. What are we going to get out of this? And it is the best version of it so far, I think.
Yeah. Because I also love that, like, again, the dedication that this game makes to making John Marston just not shit.
Yes.
Like, he's just, he's like one of the worst members of the gang, is when you're introduced to him, is when he's half frozen to death with his, like, face all clawed up by some fucking wolves. And yeah. It's like, fuck you, John, you suck.
Yeah.
Like, you ain't shit. Like, Arthur Morgan is, like, immediately 100 times cooler than John ever was, and I liked John in Red Dead Redemption 1, but, like, I'm so over that. Like, I'm onto a new man now.
It's fantastic. And it really does, it reorients your view of the first game, which is what the best prequels do. They reorient your view of whatever came before in meaningful, substantive ways. Is Arthur Morgan ever mentioned in Red Dead 1?
I don't think so. So I would have to replay it.
Yeah, because I've been watching, like, the recap videos, and I know it's Dutch and Javier and Bill Williamson.
Bill, yeah.
But I don't remember the other ones, and I'm... one of the things I'm so curious about is, you know, this is a prequel. Some fates are determined. I have no idea where they're going with Arthur Morgan, because I feel like they could do a story where, like, the end of this game is him in 1920 and he got out alive somehow, or maybe they kill him in this game. I have no idea. And that's a cool position to be in, especially with a prequel where you think you're going to know all these things.
Yeah, so. I think the game's going to end with him being cryogenically frozen, and then there'll be a post-credit sequence where they unfreeze him in Grand Theft Auto 6.
I think that would be the best thing Rockstar could possibly do. I would play the shit out of that.
That would be pretty fucking cool, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would love to see Arthur Morgan wake up in fucking Liberty City and have him walk around and be, like, staring at cars with this, like, big wide-eyed expression. It's like, what the hell happened?
It's like the end of Captain America, but much more extreme.
Yes.
Yes. Anyway, that would be great. I can't wait for that. But barring that, I'm just so curious where this character is going. Let's end by talking about the elephant in the room with Red Dead 2.
Right, yeah.
Which is, you can't ignore the human cost it put into this. And I think I want to start with, you know, we got the big report this week by Jason Schreier about the working conditions at Rockstar. This was not out last week, right?
No, yeah, okay. We definitely have not talked about it.
And it's a fantastic article. It is a towering piece of video game journalism. It is very long, but I would recommend you read the entire thing because it paints a much more nuanced portrait than I was expecting to read. It is not just, holy shit, Rockstar is evil, and it's not just, this is all overblown. It is very much a portrait of a real place where people are making art, they are suffering for it, in some ways completely unduly. In some ways, the ways you would expect people who are making art to, you know, put themselves into it, you get a sense of people who are really proud of the work, but can also be really angry about how they were made to do the work. Like, they are of two minds, the people who feel abused by the system, but also feel incredibly proud of the game they made. And I guess I want to start where Jason Schreier starts, which is, his article starts with the revelation that the black bars, the cinematic anamorphic widescreen thing the game does in cutscenes and in the cinematic camera, that was added in the last year of development. It was kind of a last-minute move. It wound up adding a lot of crunch to everyone's schedules to reorient the visuals to fit this. And I've been thinking about it a lot because I think that's one of the best parts of the game. I think the way it uses the widescreen aspect ratio, I literally cannot imagine the game without it. I think, other than maybe Virginia, that indie game from a couple years ago that uses widescreen, I've never seen a game use the widescreen gimmick this effectively. It really does feel cinematic. It feels amazingly composed. I think that cinematic camera thing is a goddamn magic trick, and I'm amazed it works as well as it does. I think when they go to widescreen, it's kind of like a much more high-tech version of what, like, Ocarina of Time did back in the day. Of, like, you bring the bars in, and you're going to do something dramatic with it, and it is, like, this high-tech, super-polished, artistic version of that. And I'm thinking, like, this would not be the game it is without that, and yet that led to all this crunch. And I don't know what to say about that. I don't know if there is an answer. The thing I like about Jason's article is that there isn't an answer, because the people who worked on this don't have an answer. It's really tough to know what to say about the human cost of these things, but I've been thinking about it a lot because one of my absolute favorite things about this game is one of the things that maybe caused the most, like, turmoil in terms of getting it made.
Yeah, it's because I'm 100% with you with the black bars, and it is very hard. It's especially, like, it's something that sold me on the game immediately in the opening, because I think, like, that opening is so slow and steady and like builds so slowly that like you need the kind of like the filmic language that those bars evoke, and that the way that those shot, like those scenes are shot and edited in the cutscenes, like that does so much for getting me into the tone of the game immediately, that I'm with you, that I think it is, if you, especially if you're like very easily able to sort of like ignore the like amount of human cost it took to implement them, from like a purely creative point of view, it is 100% clearly the right choice to do that. Yeah, what is really complicated and hard to parse out is like how those decisions create crunch and like create human cost in the work, and how intense the work is, and how that's one like distributed across different studios in different ways. So that's the one of the really complicated parts of Jason Schreier's report is, you know, Rockstar is not one studio. Any AAA studio is not really one studio. They have a bunch of different locations. Red Dead Redemption 2 is also the only game that Rockstar has made so far where all their different branches have all, we're all making this game. You know, it used to be like Rockstar San Diego made Red Dead Redemption 2 while the main studio in New York was making Grand Theft Auto 5, right? Like that's how they used to have more releases on the last generation, is that different studios were handling different things and different projects. Red Dead Redemption 2, everybody was making fucking Red Dead Redemption 2. As soon as GTA 5 was done, obviously they had like people working on GTA Online stuff at the different studios, but every studio was touching this game. And so the different work policies and the nature of crunch, depending on who you were, like what team you were in and what studio you were in, are all very different. And so that's like a whole other complicating factor. But one thing I think we can really focus on that his report sheds light on are the kinds of practices that are clearly unfair, the kind of culture that is clearly non-productive, and it's like the kind of tack that is much easier to take is the where it is very convenient that crunch is both bad from like a human like health point of view, and it is also bad from a productivity point of view, where like the nature of what Rockstar's crunch was is if you read his report, there are long stretches where a bunch of those studios where you have people working there like in the office that are basically doing nothing but are only there because we need to have the appearance of everybody being here because one of the studio leads, like one of the Housers or somebody, is coming through. So we need to have it like it look like all hands are on deck. Like even if, you know, you'd have nothing to do this week because there's some sort of bottleneck in animation or coding or whatever is happening, like, and you're, you know, a concept artist or whatever the fuck you're doing, and you have like basically nothing you can do, they would still have people come into the office and be there for long days, because of the kind of studio pressure and because of the culture that creates, that makes it very difficult to have people that it's like, if they could be off, to actually take that time off. And those are the kinds of things that like the video game industry and developers need to take a really hard look at. And it's one of those things that a union would be so good at being able to put policies into place where, as we talked about last week, the thing you need to do is fix the culture. And if you fix the culture, then you fix this problem of having people who, like, you know, are the like heads of studios and stuff that Schreier was interviewing, and like the heads of human resources and public relations and stuff, that are all talking about like, well, you know, nobody, like, we are not mandating overtime and nobody's mandating crunch and pulling all that bullshit out. But then seeming to be so naive and ignorant to not understand like the very real cultural forces and psychological forces that are put in place by those exact people that cause people to be working crunch when they don't need to be, and running themselves ragged when they could be spending their time way more efficiently. And having that, like, everybody has to be at their desk for like 12 hours when we're in crunch mode, no matter what you're doing, is stupid. It's ignorant. It's a incredibly ill-conceived and unproductive way to run any sort of studio, any sort of creative venture, any sort of venture of any color, you know? And it's that kind of stuff that I hope getting all those policies like out into the light the way that Jason Schreier has makes it so that people can really look at this and be like, yo, like, this is the shit that's fucked up. Like, this and the, probably like the most venomous like fucked up thing was the policy about that it seems like Rockstar is hopefully now going to like not do, is not crediting people who worked on the game because they weren't there, quote, for the finish line. It was just like, dude, this game has been in development for like 7 or 8 years at this point. You could have had like almost an entire fucking career in game development ended that career and been working on this game the whole time and not be credited on it if you left like a year before the game came out but were working on it near the beginning. That's fucked up. There's no excuse for that.
No excuse. And that was probably... That was like the one that was the most egregious thing, I think, in his report, because that's just vindictive and petty and ultra shitty. What I think came out of it with a lot of it is exactly what you're saying. Like, it's a culture thing. I think some of the executives at Rockstar, like the Hauser brothers, sound like characters who need to get their heads on straighter of, like, of getting some of the ego out of the room. But a lot of it is, it sounds like there's a lot of good people who maybe, you know, are team leaders and department heads and stuff like that, who genuinely do not see the problem because they don't realize the effect they, as a team leader working along, has on other people, you know? And that it's just a culture shift that, like, and it seems like those are reasonable people who, if made aware of this, would genuinely want to take the steps to change it. And I think reading that article and playing the game and seeing that this game is, it is a creative triumph. It is a game where the scale is not incidental. It does not feel like Rockstar is throwing their money around because they can. It feels like a genuine creative vision that hundreds, if not thousands, of people contributed to. And I believe that can be done in a humane way. I do. Yeah. I believe that that can be done the right way. And I think having a union would go a long way towards that, just so there is a way for employees and their employers to talk about these things and for there to be guardrails and so people don't have these miscommunications, which is a lot of it. But it's going to take the effort. And I think if anyone could lead the industry on that and put in the effort, it would be Rockstar. They absolutely have the resources to do this. You know, they literally have, the Grand Theft Auto 5 has made more money than any other video game ever. If they do not have the resources, nobody does. And, you know, they are the ones pioneering this, you know, having all of their studios around the world working on this one game, which, again, creatively feels like that was the right choice for them on this game. But it also feels like if they're going to do that, they have to be responsible in how they manage this around the world. And maybe if you're going to do the black bars thing and it's going to add crunch, maybe you maybe you can't delay the game. Maybe you hire more people. Maybe you, you know, make some changes here and there and you pull people off. You know, you like, you really think about how you're going to manage your staff layout and everything, instead of just making people work longer and having incidental fallout of that, of people working who don't necessarily have a thing to do at night when everyone else is crunching. I think this can be improved upon, and I think one of the things you see in Jason's report is that the people who work in these industries want it to be improved. They are not, you know, they are angry about it maybe, but it's not like they want to say, fuck you, video game industry, I'm out and I never want to think about it again. It's, I want this to be a place where we can all do creative work productively, and I think it can be done. And I hope this is a flashpoint in the conversation, because it would be great to look back on Red Dead 2 and say, man, that's a great game. It took all this crunch. That sucks. But it was awesome that that led us to do things about it, you know? Yeah. And there's a real opportunity there. And Rockstar could very well be the ones who use their power for good on this, and I hope they do. In the making of the inevitable Grand Theft Auto 6 that will make $75 billion or whatever, you know. Because, you know, whatever effort they put into it, they're going to get it. They're going to get that effort back in the money they make on these games. They are the most, like what they put out makes fucking bank. We have not heard the sales numbers for Red Dead 2, but I am sure Monday morning there will be a breathless report about how much money it made. And we will talk about it next week. But anyway, a lot of things we could talk about here, but I feel like that's probably a good place to wrap it up. Any other thoughts on Red Dead 2 for now?
It is good. I like it.
Yes. All right. We will talk about all of this more next week. For now, Sean, we get to what's increasingly becoming a depressing part of the show, which makes me sad. It's Doctor Who. It's a show. It exists. It's not very good these days, which sucks. But we had episode 4 this week of the new season, Arachnids in the UK, written once again by Chris Chibnall, a man who does not appear to be very good at writing Doctor Who, starring a bunch of actors who are really great, and I would love for them to have the material they need to really be their best, and with a story that was gibberish nonsense bullshit, and a horrible guest performance by Chris Noth, and there were moments that were better than moments in previous episodes, but by the end I was just tired and bored, and I was like, this is not the show I love in any incarnation. This is just kind of a dull, generic sci-fi show that if it were just these 4 episodes and I'd seen nothing else, I would not be watching it and I would not be recommending it to other people. So maybe I said too much just now. But that's what I came out of this episode thinking. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, I'm not as much doom and gloom. In the way that, like, I don't know. I feel like our positions have, like, swapped somehow, where I was, like, really doom and gloom for the first two episodes, and then it was, like, I'm slightly more positive on the last two, and you were slightly more positive on the first two and got more doom and gloom. And I don't, maybe we're, like, it's a sine cosine wave thing, and we'll flop again for the next two episodes. Who knows? But yeah, it's, I mean, maybe it's something of where I'm, like, not surprised anymore by the ways in which it falls short, because the ways in which this episode falls short are the exact same ways that the past three episodes have fallen short, in that, like, the first 15 minutes are pretty good. Like, yeah, yep. I'm kind of like the setup, and I like all the character stuff they're doing. And then, like, the little middle chunk of the episode is, like, there's still some good character stuff, but this plot seems kind of weird. And then the ending is like, what the fuck are you even... What the fuck are you even doing? What is happening in this episode of Doctor Who? And then, like, and they're the ways they fall apart are so similar that also this is the fourth fucking episode of Doctor Who in a row that has some strange instance of illogical morality from the Doctor in a way that's like, I think that Chris Chibnall doesn't know what morality is. Like, it's so baffling to me that four fucking episodes in a row we get this weird shit where it's like the Doctor is against killing, but like kills in, or like creates scenarios that are like kind of more horrifying than a normal death for these creatures. And it's like, how is there no reckoning on this show at some point that, like, there was no addressing of the fact that Ryan smoked that fucking dude last episode? That's just gone. I feel like we're never touching that again. That just fucking happened, you know. That's Matt Smith blowing up the dude in Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. So it's like, that's where we are. But yeah, like, all four episodes have had that. All four episodes have had incredibly messy, strange conclusions that are not built up to properly at all, that do not feel like they resolve anything. All four episodes have some sort of moment near the end that is not emotionally earned in any way, that feels like, yep. I don't know how, like, why it often accompanied with, like, the Doctor making a speech that I don't understand why the Doctor is making a speech right now, that feels like it's supposed to connect to some sort of core plot, like, thematic element of the plot, but does not in any way. Like, the Doctor has this whole line in this episode about, like, and every life form has the exact same impulse, they all want to go home. It's like, that sounds like a line that's supposed to be, like, summing up the thematic thrust of the episode at the beginning of the third act, but that's not enough. Like, there are pieces of here that could be the thematic thrust if you wrote the episode that way, but that's not at all what this episode is about. I do not know why you put this line in here, Chris Chibnall. Like, the way that this episode falls apart, it's like we watched the same episode four different times with a different skin on it, and it's really weird. It's freaking me out, Jonathan.
It is, and, you know, it's weird you say the doom and gloom thing. I guess for me what it is I actually think these last two episodes were probably better than the first two. Absolute sense. But they're still just so mediocre. And like the definition of mediocre, and that it feels like the absolute minimal effort was put into coming up with a story. A couple of decent lines were written for the characters. And they try to get to some emotional places that are entirely unearned. And it's like every episode is relying on the viewer to put it all together in their head and be like, I'll decide how this last scene emotionally connects to the acts of this episode, because there is actually no connective tissue, but I have to create it for any of this to make sense. And so it feels like the writing is just lazy and vapid and utterly devoid of substance. There has been no substance to these four episodes other than a little bit of, every once in a while you remember Bradley Walsh's character is sad, and there feels like there's some substance there because Bradley Walsh is really good. And then you feel like, but there could be so much more if they did all these other things differently and they actually wrote to that instead of around that. And four episodes in, I mean, we're 40% of the way through the season. We're going to hit the halfway point next week. And there's nothing here. This does not feel special or ambitious. It's Doctor Who, sort of, but without any real ambition or imagination in the storytelling. It is it's Mad Libs Doctor Who, and it feels like every episode is a skeleton version of itself, and there's no meat on the bones, and it sucks when you have actors like Jodie Whittaker and Bradley Walsh and Mandip Gill, who we learn is really good in this episode. Now that Yaz finally has something to do, I'd love to see more of her. And Tossin Cole, who was barely in this episode. And I'm like, these are good actors. I think you could make a great ensemble out of this. But now I'm just repeating what we've said in past weeks. There's kind of nothing here. You know, something I said on Twitter today is, I think what's really solidified this for me is just like, let's take, so Arachnids in the UK, we can go through later, like, what are the specific problems with this one. They're pretty much just find and replace versions of what we've had in previous weeks, right? Although there's a very specific thing with Chris Noth's character of, like, what the fuck are they doing here? We'll get to. But, like, the best version of this episode, Sean, the platonic ideal of Arachnids in the UK, is a halfway decent RTD episode.
Yeah.
Like, that's the best it could be, is an RTD episode that Russell T. Davies would, like, write on an off week. You know? Like, it's an okay one. This is Jodie Whittaker's fourth episode. Real quickly, what are the fourth episodes of the other modern Doctors? For the Ninth Doctor, Chris Eccleston, it's Aliens of London. Not my favorite two-parter, not Russell T. Davies' finest hour, but that is absolutely one of those, like, flag-planting episodes for Russell T. Davies of, like, this is how he tells stories. And it is an ambitious two-parter that, again, the farting aliens thing, the Slitheen, not my favorite thing in the world, but I also see Russell T. Davies' voice in that, you know, establishing itself. Yeah. David Tennant's fourth episode is School Reunion, where we got Sarah Jane back, and we had the dude from Buffy, and we had K-9, and it's not the best episode ever, but it's a pretty darn good one for David
Tennant.
It's
not the best episode, but fucking K-9's in it, and Sarah Jane's in it, and that's good.
And it also does a lot to establish Tennant's doctor, and how he views, like, friendship and things like that.
Yeah, that one has one of my favorite David Tennant cold opens, where he pops in as, like, the physics teacher.
That's great.
That's fucking a classic David Tennant moment.
This gets even better when we go to Stephen Moffat. Matt Smith's fourth episode is The Time of Angels, the two-parter with all the fucking angels, and it is just that two-parter is high on its own creativity and finding crazy ways to use the angels in, like, an action movie setting and being scary and zany and awesome. And then Peter Capaldi's fourth episode is fucking Listen. It's Listen. It is, like, the most conceptually brilliant episode of Doctor Who up to that point in the modern era until next season you got Heaven Sent. So, like, those are episodes that are, in one way or another, swinging for the fences and planting a flag of what is the voice of this show going to be in this era. And this episode is, there's spiders, and they're a little bit bigger than normal spiders because someone polluted the garbage, and the spiders were in the garbage, so the spider, like, what the, like, again, like, I feel like I'm being too hard on the show, and then I lay it out, and I'm like, no, this is horrible. This is such stupid storytelling. It's about spider carcasses and toxic waste. There's zero ambition to this thing. Am I wrong on that?
No. Like, you are 100% right that it is, because that is the scene that after I finished watching the episode, and then several hours later, I was like, oh, we have to record the podcast. And I was like, I need to watch that scene where they break into the coal mine or whatever with all the waste. Because it's like, what the fuck were they even talking about? What the fuck was the spider scientist lady ever talking about at any point in this episode? Because I just don't know. I just don't know.
I have quotes here because I was taking notes. There is a line where scientist lady says something about, or this might even be in the doctor's mouth, spider pheromones disrupting the spider ecosystem. And I just wrote, this is very stupid in all caps. Because, like, that's the thing. This season is almost exclusively spectacularly stupid stories dressed up superficially to look like prestige television. Like, we're going to be in widescreen and we're going to have nice effects, kind of, not in this episode, but, like, we're going to, like, make it look expensive and we're going to have cool titles and a crystal in the TARDIS and all this stuff, and we're going to make it look really prestige-y, and we're going to put zero effort into coming up with a story worthy of all that. You know, like in the Rosa episode, we're going to have the veneer of doing a great historical story, but the plot is about some random time agent going up and putting posters saying the bus is canceled, and then they have to go and pull down the posters. It's like, what the fuck are you even doing here? This is like, that's the thing, is I keep pulling myself out of this and being like, if I were not a Doctor Who fan, And someone told me, like, I have told people, like, oh, come into Doctor Who this year. It's a new Doctor. It's a great time to come in. I'd be watching this going, like, what the hell is special about this? Like, what do you mean spider pheromones and disrupting the spider? What? This show's been on for 55 years? You people are high. That's what I'd be feeling.
Yeah. No, it's because it does have, you know, the all the other downfalls are pale in comparison to the biggest downfall, which is that there's nothing at the core of this episode. It's not trying to get at anything. It's not trying to say anything. It's not trying to explore anything. It's not trying to, you know, make some sort of didactic moral statement. It's not trying to explore some sort of interesting thematic concept. It's not asking any big question that doesn't have a solid answer like Listen does. It's not, you know, it's not doing anything. It is doing is taking some characters that we like that are played by actors that we really love, giving a couple of them a couple of decent jokes throughout the episode, and then you kind of expend all the character stuff you can manage to do in about 15 to 20 minutes, and then you're left running around with a monster, and then it has to be over at some point, so it ends. And this is the one that has the most it ends plot of them all in a way that feels like there isn't like even a full resolution because they never deal with the core problem, because the core problem was never like, this is the most mind-blowing thing about this episode to me, is it doesn't even follow like any sort of basic storytelling level competency for a like 45 minute episode of, or like 50 minute episode of Doctor Who or television or anything, which is you have the twist that is like, oh, we thought the spiders are the real threat. And then you have the twist that spiders aren't the real threat. Which, by the way, we already had that episode that did that, which was Kill the Moon. Not an episode I like. Better episode than this one, because at least Kill the Moon then says the spiders aren't the real threat. The real issue here is the moon is a giant egg. Now, that's a stupid fucking idea. That was stupid then, is stupid now. I do not like Kill the Moon basically at all. But at least it recognizes that, like, we have to shift from the spider thing, which is the sexy antagonist. At the end of, like, the first act, you kind of get the hint that, like, that's probably not really what this is about. And you spend the second act exploring what the real issue is. At the end of the second act, beginning of the third act of the story of the episode, you reveal this is what the real thing is. Then you spend the third act resolving what the real threat is. And that episode, it becomes a weird sort of, like, abortion metaphor or whatever. It's, you know, Kill the Moon is not the world's greatest episode, but at least it's trying to do what it's trying to do. At least it's trying to say something about something, even if it's very clunkily doing it. And at least it follows a basic storytelling structure that resolves at the end whether you like the story or not. This one has the moment. I mean, it gets to the moment too late, because it gets at the end of the second act of the episode. It gets at the end. It's like 35, 40 minutes into the episode that they fucking even discover the coal mine thing and the trash. But they discover that that's what the real problem is. And then they proceed to spend the rest of the episode killing all the spiders and then leave. It's like, but the problem was the toxic fucking waste that made the mutant spiders in the first place, and the, like, really awkward, horribly written Trump guy who made all of that. Like, that's the real villain and the real problem, and we're not even gesturing at a resolution to that. That guy just fucking shoots a giant spider and walks off, and you didn't even address that issue, and you never go back to, you don't even get a throwaway line about the Doctor calling fucking UNIT or something to say, like, go clean up this fucking bullshit that's making mutant spiders, because, you know, we're making mutant spiders. Also, there is another mutant spider that is back at that lady's house that's a neighbor of Yaz that never gets dealt with. So that's still there. So there's still a giant mutant spider hanging out in the city somewhere. So, you know, it's such a fucking mess.
You've hit on another thing I was thinking today, that, like, let's simplify this a level further than, like, comparing it to other Doctor Who or other fourth episodes like I did or any of this. Name a theme that has been present in any of these episodes other than racism is bad in the Rosa Parks episode.
Damn it, Jonathan, you caught me.
Okay. Other than...
I literally was about to say racism in Rosa Parks.
Other than the factual statement that racism is bad, which is not really a theme, like, you can build onto that and show, like, how racism is bad. And, like, delve, but if your theme is just racism is bad, that's not a theme.
Yeah, that's a PSA.
That's a PSA, yes. Other than that, episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, what's a theme?
You shouldn't murder people and put their teeth in your face.
Okay. That's a great theme. That's, I can't wait for the PSA where the doctor, they should do that at the end of every episode where the doctor sums up the theme of the episode. She's like, hey kids, don't murder people and put their teeth in your face.
I'll tell you what, so far, I think there's been a running theme across these four episodes, which is you should never use guns to kill things. Instead, you should blow up DNA bombs inside of them. You should immolate them alive. You should teleport them back to the past so that they slowly die in an era they were never supposed to be in. Or you lock them up in a room and cause them to die and probably self-cannibalize, which is what's going to happen to the spiders in this episode. But if you shoot the one that is about to die because it's suffocating to death because it's too big for its own body, that's evil. Setting them on fire, sending them back to the past and having them slowly die there the way the Weeping Angels did, setting DNA bombs off in their body, or, again, like having them fucking lock them in a room and have them eat each other. That's all fine. You just can't shoot them.
Okay.
Shooting them is just bad.
Let's talk on this then, because I honestly, you're joking, but you're right in that the gun control thing is probably the clearest theme we've had in these episodes. And I want to get back to the issue of theme, because it is like, if you're going to do a Doctor Who story, you have to have a theme.
Yes.
We've had four Doctor Who stories in a row completely devoid of theme, and that's like amazing to me. It's just amazing that that's happened. But we'll get back to that. You and I are both American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
You and I are both American citizens who have vocally said we think we should have tighter gun laws in this country. Much tighter. Right?
Yes. Oh, yes. Definitely. Yes. Yeah.
What the fuck is Chris Chibnall talking about in these four episodes with guns? Because it's either guns are always bad in all situations and they are inherently amoral and that is why, like, use it. Which I don't think even the strictest gun control advocate would say. Like, no, if you want to, like, go to a fucking shooting range and have fun shooting at a target, go broke. We just don't want them in schools and shit. Like, right? Like,
yeah.
What the hell is the view on guns in these episodes? What the hell is the doctor's view on morality? I don't know. It's very weird, and I get that England is not like a gun-rich culture, and this is maybe a little foreign to them, but maybe put in a little research, because it's the dumbest gun control stuff I've ever seen. And I'm theoretically very sympathetic to your argument, Chris Chibnall, if you want the doctor to say guns are bad, but, like, she's doing it in, like, an absolutist way that makes no sense.
I think what it feels like to me is Chibnall, and part of this, like, kind of clicked for me in this episode, because the first 20 minutes so feel like this is like a script they pulled out of like an unused episode from series one with Christopher Eccleston, with, like, you know, and replaced Jackie with Yaz's family or whatever, you know, it's
right.
Got so much of that, like, domestic thing that RTD did, is that it kind of made me look at it in a slightly different way. Is if you remember in RTD's era, he did, you know, a lot of, like, the kind of the gun thing, particularly with David Tennant. You know, this is a big part of End of Time. The Doctor's Daughter deals with that kind of stuff, of where it's like the Doctor really doesn't like guns and he hates seeing guns. He doesn't want to touch guns. And it's like that's a pretty big part of his characterization when RTD was running the show. And it feels like Chris Chibnall watched those bits and, like, was like, oh, well, that's something I can do and bring that back, because Moffat didn't really touch on it that much without ever critically analyzing why RTD was doing that and what he was doing with it narratively. Because the reason why the ninth and tenth doctors do not use guns and have, like, a Batman-esque, like, traumatic phobic reaction to guns is because they have PTSD and they're fresh off of the fucking Time War. Like, that's the whole point of the thing. Like, it's the whole point of when the ninth doctor uses a gun when he's fighting the Dalek in Dalek. Like, that the reason is supposed to be shocking is it's like, this is not something the doctor would ever do. He's been so expressly against this kind of stuff. You know, when later, you know, he meets Jack Harkness, there's a whole running joke about, like, the square gun and the Granis gun and all that, and the doctor blowing up a gun factory and replacing with a banana factory or whatever. Like, it's a great bit in that episode. But the whole reason why that's shocking when he's fighting the Daleks and he's finally resorting to a gun is because you have built up this sense of, like, he is traumatized by guns. He hates guns. He definitely doesn't want to fucking see a gun, let alone touch one. But the Daleks are so horrifying that he's going to have to do it. Then RTD did it again in End of Time, where there's that whole great sequence in End of Time Part 2 where Wilf keeps on trying to give the Doctor his service revolver, and the Doctor says, no, I'm never going to use a gun, ever. And then he finds that the Master's plan is to bring back a Time Lord, and he's like, yo, Wilf, hand me that piece. Like, I'm going to shoot some motherfuckers now. Like, because it's like, that's how bad the Time Lords are, is that the Doctor has to, like, sees no other way to resolve this problem other than to resort to violence, which is a very non-Doctor-like thing to do, but it's a very compelling, interesting narrative, like, twist in direction to take the series, and to take that story. And then Moffat kind of, like, cleared the table, and, you know, it's not like the Doctor, there's no period in the history of the show where the Doctor's just willy-nilly fucking firing guns all over the place. But, you know, the fourth Doctor uses a gun in, like, Invasion of Time. The sixth Doctor uses a gun in the Cyberman episode of those. There are other instances that I don't have off the top of my head. But it happens. And then, you know, like, the 11th, like, the one you pointed out, Time of the Angels, his fourth episode, he uses a gun in that one. He shoots the fucking gravity orb. Like, it happens, and it doesn't have to be a big deal because he's not shooting somebody with the gun. The problem is not just, like, right. The gun itself. The problem is gun violence.
This is like where we would go into, like, this is one of the conservative arguments in the U.S. on gun control is it's not about the inherent nature of the weapon. It's about what you do with it, which I completely agree with. We just have to, you know, then you get into the nuances of, but we make it too easy for people to do the things with the weapons.
Yeah.
You know.
The problem with gun control in America and why it's such a big issue is because it is this large-scale problem that we've created. It is like... like, a gun in and of itself, and the fact that guns were invented, like, I'm not a huge fan of them, but that's not itself the whole problem. And it also makes it that it's like, when you're telling a story, if you have in this individual instance, this one specific character using a gun as a tool in a nonviolent way to like, solve this problem, that shouldn't be a big deal. Like, that should be fine, unless it's like Batman, who is traumatized by guns, or the Doctor, who is traumatized by the own violence that he himself committed in the Time War, there is like a character justification for it. Here, especially because they have not spent almost any time sitting with this Doctor, you get a little bit more with it in the sort of domestic setting in this episode, but not much. And even then, it's almost all used for a zany, quirky, like, I'm going to reference some like historical figure and make a joke, which is fine. But that's still the only mode of the Doctor we've gotten, and you just get the briefest, vaguest of hints of anything deeper from her right now. We are not introduced into anything of this Doctor's, like, psychology, or even a hint at, like, a mystery behind the psychology of why she doesn't like guns. She's just like, guns, no, thank you. I'd rather lock these things in a room and have them eat each other. Like, that seems way, way cooler and a way more specific. Like, they use the word humane several times. It's like, I don't know, Christopher, if you know what the word fucking humane means, because that it doesn't seem that humane to me, locking all these spiders in this room. Like, I'm not a big fan of spiders. I think it's also questionable, you know, you can have a lot of sort of philosophical debates about, like, whether or not spiders could even feel pain, and that would not change if they were suddenly way bigger. Like, and that has to do with the way their nervous systems are constructed. So it's like, whether, like, humaneness exists with an animal that is so reactive, I don't know. That's like neither here nor there. It's just fucking weird to be so uppity about this animal that is slowly dying to death, and then the American dude shoots it with a gun. You're like, how could you? You didn't even give it the chance to slowly suffer from its own body weight and crush itself with its own incredible mass. How could you possibly shoot it, you cruel monster? It would be like, you know, like, you know, the Doctor showing up in Ole Yeller and just being livid about putting Ole Yeller down. It's like, you're not presenting any better options.
How could you not get Ole Yeller go rabid and bite your whole family and then die in its own, you know, drool as it dies of rabidity?
Yeah, it's like, how dare you shoot Ole Yeller? Like, why don't you just, like, lock it in a cellar and leave it there with no food or water, any way to survive? Like, that's the way more humane way to deal with this dog than shooting it and killing it, you know, instantly.
Yeah, I just, again, you know, at least we're only four episodes in, so if they steer the ship right, we could still just write this all off as the Doctor is just post-regenerative, still does not have her head together fully, and does not realize what morality is yet. But if we get, like, two seasons in here and the 13th Doctor is still this weirdly amoral, because that is what it is ultimately, is it's like the weirdest, it's a code of morals so complicated it's ultimately amorality, then that's not right.
It's like, it's also, it's like, it's a morality that is so rigidly specific around some, like, a, like, academic point of like, the usage of guns in any way in solving this problem that in no way has any sort of moral philosophy or fiber behind it, because it doesn't have any relationship to suffering. It doesn't have, like, there's no sort of religious underpinning to it, so there's no, like, appeal to, like, an ultimate good that the doctor's ever making. She's not a fucking paladin or something, you know? Like, it's, because the doctor's morality has always been complicated and flexible, because the doctor exists in a very complicated and flexible world, and, you know, the doctor is a character capable of incredible compassion, but also incredible violence when the time comes, and that's one of the things that's really interesting about the character, is that the character tries to be good, is trying to be moral, but is never going to be fully successful at it, and that's what creates all the tension and drama around the character. This version of the doctor's morality is so, like, she picked it up from a textbook. Like, it almost reminds me of the weird headcanon I made for my Shepard in Mass Effect to justify my going Paragon with every single choice, which is that my Shepard was a sociopath that decided to be a good person, not because he agreed with anything morally, but just because he thought, like, that's what I should be doing from an entirely intellectual point of view, but I have no real kindness or compassion in me. I'm just manipulating everything to be the ultimate good, like, utilitarian outcome, which was an interesting characterization in my head for how I was playing that character. Is not in any way hinted at for this doctor, but is the only thing I can see behind it of, like, the doctor, like, have, like, vaguely recalling one time being like, you know what, I remember saying that, like, guns are real bad and I would never use a gun. I must have been really sure about it, so I'm just going to stick with that. Even if never using a gun means not shooting, you know, simple robots with a laser gun instead of disabling them with an EMP. Because clearly those two things are so clearly opposite on the moral scale, whether you disable them with a laser or with an electromagnetic pulse. Totally different. So totally fucking different. One of those, you should be fucking executed for doing that shit. The other thing, you get a goddamn medal for how heroic you are.
I just, you know, I can't wait next week when the episode opens with the doctor in the TARDIS's library, hanging out, reading some Kierkegaard, reading some Kant, just thinking about morality, just, you know, trying to figure it all out. No, it's... I mean, and this goes back to my point on theme, is that there is no discernible theme. And even if I think about, like, I think Kill the Moon is actually a great example, because Kill the Moon is not a particularly good episode of Doctor Who, but it's an episode that goes for something. It has a theme in mind. It has a story in mind. And I think before this season of Doctor Who, I would not have assumed those are... I would have assumed you take that for granted and then judge on top of that, right? That, like, if you're going to do a Doctor Who story, especially in the here and now when we're only doing like 13 episodes, 10 episodes a year, you're at least going to have a theme, right? You're going to have something like, I've chosen to tell this story for this reason. I can't tell you that about any of the episodes so far, with the possible exception of Rosa, which, but even then, like, it does not go beyond the surface much of racism is bad and Rosa Parks is brave, both of which are true. But I don't know what else it has to say about that, especially when you layer on all the time travel stuff that just muddies the waters of the morality of that episode and its themes. But, like, you know, Russell T. Davies is a writer I think both of us would say is not our favorite Doctor Who writer, not necessarily always our cup of tea. But I think, speaking for me at least, one of the reasons I always respected Russell T. Davies as a writer immensely of Doctor Who is he kind of swung for the fences every time he stepped up to the plate. Like, he had an idea and a theme and something he was going to go for, and he was going to go for it pretty vigorously. There's not many, like, half measures episodes of Russell T. Davies's run, you know? Like, if you think of ones like we really criticize, like Love and Monsters, or the end of season 2 when it becomes so melodramatic between the Doctor and Rose, those are bad in my view as Doctor Who storytelling choices. They're really fucking memorable. I will never forget those episodes. Because they are going for something. They have made a choice of, like, what story are we going to tell in Doctor Who today? This is, the Doctor had one true love, and it was Rose Tyler, and we're going to go crazy with it, and it's going to be sad. And, you know, God bless you, Russell T. Davies, not the story I would tell. You believed in it. And I felt that watching it. And that's at least an interesting place to be. These four episodes, I feel nothing from them. I will not remember anything about them, and I have no desire to kind of ever watch them again. Whereas an episode like Kill the Moon or Aliens of London or any other kind of bad, mediocre episode we've talked about, I'm fine watching through again when I rewatch the series because I think they're interesting in that push-pull of like what makes Doctor Who work and not work. This is just inert. We haven't even pulled into drive yet, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, I rewatched all of that stuff relatively recently in the build-up to Twice Upon a Time because I wanted to do the full that era of Doctor Who before we moved on from it. And it was like, you know, I rewatched Love and Monsters. I rewatched Doomsday. Like the last time I watched Love and Monsters was the most I enjoyed it because I was able to kind of accept it more for what it was. And I still think it's a clunky as hell episode. And it like, there's some weird fucking shit at the end of that episode that does not work at all. But it is utterly singular. There is no Doctor Who story anywhere near like it in terms of style or tone. And it has, like you said, like it has a theme. It has a basic story level telling competence that is above these episodes in that, like, you know, even if you go back to, again, Kill the Moon or the other, like, I feel like what is the other's, like, punching bag from season 8, which is In the Forest of the Night.
Which I still episodes, like.
Yes, you like that one. Like, I like it just fine. Like, I think it's that it's just above Kill the Moon in the second worst episode from that season for me, but
yes,
I don't think it's horrible, but a lot of people really hate both of those episodes a lot. Both of those episodes have like a idea and a theme and they explore it to a like sufficient level. Even if, you know, again, I don't think that they are tremendously successful. I think they're very clunky in a lot of areas in like Kill the Moon. I think like the message it's ultimately getting at is very confused. And I don't really think that the writer fully understood like the material he was playing with like the weird abortion metaphor that I'm not sure if he intentionally made it an abortion metaphor or not, but it was like that episode goes to weird fucking places with that shit, but it goes to those places with that stuff, and that stuff is seeded throughout the whole episode. It like it just does the story, it just doesn't do it perfectly or amazingly. These episodes just don't even do the full story. Like they not only do they feel, they don't even feel like first drafts, which is like the criticism we have of a lot of clunkier Doctor Who episodes of, oh, this kind of feels like more first drafty and needed to be rewritten and revised a lot and kind of put connective material. These feel like rough drafts. These
they feel like outlines.
Yes, or yeah, like an outline or like whatever your like initial pre-writing process is. Like it feels like this is not a complete draft of this episode. This is like an exploratory writing phase that you're in to try to get into the headspace to actually write the episode. And you're going to like pull ideas from it for the full episode. But it feels like you, all four of these episodes feel like, you know, Chris Chibnall / Marjorie Blackman for Rosa. But let's focus on Chibnall because he's the like the unifying factor for all these episodes, gets to the ending of the episode and then just kind of feels like, oh, this is about how long this could be and have it be roughly 50 minutes or so. And so it just has to kind of stop here. And there's no effort to then go back and make a stronger resolution. Because this is fucking, this is one of the things that blew my mind about this episode and the weird resolution to it, is that this is Doctor Who. You can do whatever the fuck you want on Doctor Who. Doctor Who, it's like the speech that the Doctor gives in The Girl Who Died. You can do anything. There's nothing he can't do, except for there's rules. But you can break the rules whenever you want in Doctor Who. That's what makes Doctor Who fucking great. That's why The Girl Who Died, he breaks the rules at the end of that episode and brings her back to life. And, you know, you get the whole fucking rest of the season from that choice. Like, it's one of the things that makes that episode really interesting. You can do whatever the fuck you want as a writer on Doctor Who. So when you get to the end of this episode and you suddenly have to resolve this issue with the spiders, and you run into this weird scenario where you want to do the gun thing because of the Trump American weird whatever that character is supposed to be doing. You want to do your gun thing, but you also need to get rid of the rest of the spiders. You don't have to write yourself into this corner where shooting this one spider is bad, but locking the rest into a room where they have no food, and so anybody who has ever seen spiders together knows they're going to fucking eat each other. Like, that's how it's going to fucking go. It's like, you don't have to do that. You could do anything. You could have the Doctor pop into the TARDIS and make a shrink ray. You could have the Doctor take all the fucking spiders and teleport them to a planet that has more oxygen and lower gravity so they can live there freely as giant fucking spiders.
Sean, what
I... You could do whatever the fuck you want to do!
Now I'm imagining the scenario where there's a scene where they are herding all the spiders into the TARDIS and you just have this, like, sea of spiders running into the fucking TARDIS, and then the Doctor gets in there in, like, a hazmat suit and is like, I'll be back in 15. And then, for me, you would go drop them off on the Planet of the Spiders from the third Doctor serial.
Metapeus 3, yeah.
Yes, you would go drop them off there, and they would be happy. And she would be like, hi, Spider Queen, you killed me once, but we're okay now. Here's some more friends for you. And, yeah, you could have done anything. You're so right. Like, this is a show with limitless possibilities, and its scope seems so small and narrow and devoid of imagination right now.
Yeah. Man, like, and then in that imaginary scenario, you even have, like, the perfect, like, kicker for the end of the episode, which is, like, the Doctor finding, like, a, like, pulling a lever and there being, like, a big piece of webbing there or something is, like, ugh, and, like, wiping it off, and then you smash the credits, you know? Like, there's so much you could do. It could be so much fun. You could do fucking literally anything, you know? This is a series that we had a couple of seasons ago, a whole episode where the TARDIS itself shrinks down to a tiny size, and there are monsters from a flat 2D universe that are trying to suck the dimension out of our universe, and it's one of the best episodes of that season. Like, the show could do fucking anything, and you can resolve it however the fuck you want, because that episode has a great resolution where Clara tricks the fucking flat monsters into shooting dimensional energy into the tiny TARDIS by making a fake, like, fucking Wile E. Coyote wall of, like, painting a door on the wall and putting the TARDIS behind it. And it fucking works because that episode's really strong, and you just buy it once you get to that point. But when you just say that conclusion, it sounds ridiculous. But Doctor Who can fucking pull that shit off. And this episode, like, doesn't have the ambition to even try for something like that, and it isn't even able to pull off its lower ambition, partially because it's probably because it doesn't have any ambition. It's not even trying to think enough outside the box to have an interesting resolution, because once you get to that spot where you have an interesting solution to this spider problem, then all of a sudden you open up all that space to maybe make some sort of thematic thing about how even if they're disgusting and horrible, it's wrong to end another life like that when it's not trying to mean you any harm. You know, like, whatever theme you wanted to do with the gun shit, you could have done it. You just can't do it when the Doctor resolves the scenario by making all the spiders eat each other, which is, like, the implied post-end of this episode. It's just bizarre.
You know what else you could do on Doctor Who, Sean? You could have denouements that have something to do with the episode that came before, rather than putting your goddamn show on iPod shuffle mode, which is what this season has done. Because the end of this episode, the last 5 minutes, is the characters go back to their life, realize, I don't want to do this, and they go to the TARDIS, and they decide now they're going to be the TARDIS crew, Team TARDIS, as they say, and they're going to go on adventures with the Doctor. Great. It's a scene that in absolute isolation I could see being effective, because Bradley Walsh has a beautiful line about grief and how it is always with him and how this is a way he could escape his grief, and Ryan and Yaz have decent lines about something. And the Doctor is vulnerable in that moment and wants to have friends. And there's a great moment early on in the episode where she's thinking about leaving, but she clearly just wants to be invited to tea, and she is. And it's very funny and cute and sweet and feels very in character for the Doctor. But that last scene, that should have been an emotional highlight of the season, as it is in any season when the companion decides to join the Doctor for real now. I felt nothing, because there is not one goddamn second of this episode that builds to the idea that any of these people want to escape their lives and therefore want to go with the Doctor. I mean, I guess you do. Okay, you have the scene where Bradley Walsh goes and visits his house and feels the wife's presence. Beautiful little scene. Has nothing to do with the main plot with the spiders and the threat. The main adventure they go on does nothing to further their, like, feelings of, you know, ennui about the modern world, and now they want to go with the Doctor. It does nothing to, like, bring them closer to the Doctor. It's just this adventure that comes out of nowhere, and then at the end they make this choice that is not motivated because of anything they did in this episode. And I can't believe I have to explain this to the show, because this is, like, storytelling 101. You know, go watch Rose. Watch how Russell T. Davies sets up Rose Tyler's life so you see why Chris Eccleston might be an exciting alternative, you know? Like, it's not hard. Rose did not, like, crack some mystical gateway for storytelling that was hidden to us before then. It just told a fucking story. Again, it's like iPod Shuffle. You could take that ending of this episode and put it at the end of any other episode of Doctor Who this season, even the ones where she doesn't have the TARDIS yet, and it would make just as much sense.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. And it's one of the things that feels like 4 episodes in, the fucking three companion thing is not working out.
Oh, no.
Like, it's because one of the other things about this episode is that this is definitely the most Yaz we've gotten, and yet somehow I still feel like she doesn't really have much of a character, and like her deciding, I don't see why she decides to stay with the Doctor. Like, there's no...
She says her family annoys her, but we don't see that in the episode.
Yeah, because the thing that's amazing about this episode is that this is the episode where they go and visit Yaz's family, and Yaz is the character that spends the least amount of time with her fucking family. Like, the Doctor and Ryan and Graham... Or no, the Doctor and Ryan, because Graham's back at his house. But the Doctor and Ryan have more screen time and more interactions with her fucking father and sister. And then, you know, Yaz has a little bit of stuff with her mom, but all that stuff is once you get the plot rolling, and so there's no real focus on it, and there's no development on it. It's just like this, like, he would random just be like a random character in an episode of Doctor Who, like the spider scientist lady is. She just, this one just happens to be Yaz's mom, but there's not like much more to it than that.
Also, the relationship shifts, and most of the interaction is between Yaz's mom and the Doctor, because they have that running gag where she always says Yaz's mom, and she says it's Nadia.
Yeah, exactly. So like, even in the episode that's supposed to be the Yaz episode, it's like we were coming into this one being like, well, finally it's Yaz time. There's no way you do the episode where you introduce her whole fucking family and then not have that episode be about her and who she is and why she wants to be a part of the TARDIS team, the way that we've had with Ryan and how Ryan has been affected by, even though, you know, Ryan has been underdeveloped in the last couple of episodes, the first one sets him up more than well enough as dealing with grief, dealing with his own sort of emasculation related to dyspraxia and his you know, inability to ride that bike and all that stuff. Even if it's not drawing clear lines, there is like a good character reason, and I can see that character. Yes, you'd want to join the Doctor. I'm fine with that. Graham has by far the best. He's by far the best companion so far.
The most
development for him. He's the funniest. He gets the best lines, and he's the best acted. And he gets the most attention. So it's like kind of everything is Graham. If we had to get rid of the next two companions, or if we had to get rid of two of these companions, fucking Ryan and Yaz are getting voted off the TARDIS, and Graham is staying because I like Graham a lot. Sadly, he's going to be the one that dies from cancer at the end of the season or whatever, because he, you know, is the cancer survivor. But yeah, so Graham...
If you put a malignant tumor in the first act, that tumor must no longer be malignant in the 10th act.
Yeah, exactly. It's just going to happen. But, you know, Graham has the whole... He has by far the most developed thing with, you know, him trying to run away from grief. Even if the plot, the spider shit, has nothing to do with that, there was at least a scene that established that in this episode, which is more than Ryan's gotten since episode one. So,
yes.
Or unless you count, like, him being like, oh, I don't like climbing ladders in episode two, if you want to count that one, which
no.
I do. Yeah, but Yaz has nothing. Yaz has, she bitched about her sister wanting her room in episode two. Her sister seems slightly annoying, but not in a way that's like a, this is, you know, it's not a, I don't know, like Martha situation from season three with David Tennant, where it felt like, you know, Martha was not the most developed of companions, but her family life and her sense of being kind of stuck in that family life and with the expectations around her was a lot clearer and gave her a much better reason to go off with the Doctor. Also, she wanted to fuck him. And so that, like, you know, those two things kind of coincided. Nobody's trying to fuck anybody on this TARDIS other than maybe Ryan and Yaz. And so, like, Yaz just doesn't have a great anything there. Like, she's just there because she's Yaz. Hey, you're cool, Yaz. Like, the Doctor keeps on saying you're really cool in this episode, so you're cool, Yaz.
Also, it's like, so let's talk about the three-person dynamic, because Graham has been well-used in every episode, we would agree. Well, as well-used as anyone is being right now.
Yes.
On the curve of Doctor Who Series 11, he's been well-used. And then it's been a trade-off where, like, episode one, we also had good Ryan, no Yaz. Episode two, decent Ryan, no Yaz. Episode three, Ryan and Yaz both kind of got shafted and had their one conversation about racism that was not very well written. And then episode four, it's some Yaz, no Ryan whatsoever, except for that one scene where he starts to talk about his dad out of nowhere, and then they cut it off because they're like, that was our 30 seconds of allotted character development in this episode for this character. And what confuses me so much is that, and I was confused when I saw in episode one, you know, they did that preview with the long list of guest actors, and all I could think is, you have a four-person crew, what are you doing with that many guest actors per episode? and in Arachnids in the UK, I'm like, why do you have a four-person crew and you add on top of that as main figures in this episode, Yaz's dad, Yaz's mom, Yaz's sister, the weird scientist lady, and Chris Noth. You add five people, you over double the size of the ensemble in a 50-minute episode, many of those characters being utterly superfluous, because what if you just made Yaz's mom a fucking scientist and then you have her do both of those? You don't need Chris Noth, because the, like, evil capitalist thing in the episode never comes up. It's never something they have to confront. It's not important at all for the episode. So, like, it's just, again, it's inept in terms of balancing your TARDIS crew. Like, you know, yes, in the William Hartnell era, you had a TARDIS crew and you would have lots of guest stars in the episode, but that's because you had six fucking episodes to fill, and you had 3 hours of story, or 2 hours of story, or something like that, and you could balance all of that. Like, the Aztecs has just as many guest characters, but they also have four full half-hour episodes, so 2 full hours to do that story, and they do it very well. This just, I don't get the decision to add all these characters on top of the characters you're already not using. It's like, you can't play with new toys until you play with the toys you already have.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. And one of the other things that's really is a big difference between this and the Aztecs is that there's like a solid, like the back half of this episode has a full 7 fucking characters running around in that hospital. Yeah. You have the 4 TARDIS team, you have Chris Noth, you have Yaz's mom, and then you have Scientist Lady. It's like, you have 7 fucking people you have to juggle running around this hospital or this hotel, like dealing with this weird spider thing. And that's part of where it gets so confused and messy when they have to split up and you just have that fucking Ryan Graham scene you alluded to earlier where Ryan like pulls the fucking letter out or whatever. He's talking about his dad to Graham. This just feels like because it's like the scientist lady just says, oh, we need to see, I feel like there are bigger spiders out there. Can you go see if there are bigger spiders? For no reason. Like, there's just no justifiable reason. I don't even know why they needed to catch the spider that they had Ryan and Graham catch in the first place. I don't know what the fucking plot point of that was.
They never do anything with it.
Yeah, they don't do anything with it. I don't know what the science-y reason was. The doctor just says, we need to catch one of the spiders, and so they catch one of the spiders, and it never comes up again, and then the scientist lady is like, oh, we need to go find out if maybe there are bigger spiders also, and so Ryan and Graham go outside so they can have, like, a good scene where they're like, did you check the ceiling? No, neither did I, and look up, and there's a giant fucking spider up there, and that's, like, a decent little scene that would have been a decent scene if the rest of the episode was built around that, but like, right around that is when you have everybody else discovering the underground toxic waste or whatever that is the real threat of the episode. This, like, so much shit that's so confusing and just bouncing all over the place. And one of the main reasons is they have 7 characters to balance on top of, like, the 4 main characters that they, like, really need to be focusing on. So they have to split those 4 characters in 2. But you don't even have enough plot for one group of characters to fulfill. You certainly do not have enough plot to have another little section where another group of characters get to do something, because it's just it's such a pulp plot cul-de-sac that they go on. I don't even know if it counts as a plot cul-de-sac. It's just so nothing. It's so meaningless.
Yeah, it's a plot void.
Yes, it's just, the plot black hole.
They float in space for a little while. Chris Noth, as someone who is neither an avid viewer of Sex and the City nor of Law and Order SVU, I cannot...
Criminal Intent, sorry. Let's get our Law and Order series right. It's a good one, not the bad one.
Okay, which is the one about sex offenders?
That's SVU.
Okay, and what's Criminal Intent about?
It's more kind of almost like Sherlock Holmesy, and it's mostly about like serial killers and stuff. It's okay. Very good. The Chris Noth episodes aren't great, but Vincent D'Onofrio kind of like came up in TV doing that after he did Full Metal Jacket. So.
Oh, nice. Okay.
It's very good.
As a viewer of neither of those shows, I have never seen either of those shows. I cannot speak to this man's acting ability in other scenarios, but he's fucking horrible in this episode. It is, like, it's not really scenery chewing. It's, like, just scenery fucking, just awful performance. He's just yelling, and they've given him all these character tics, like, scheduled bathroom breaks that go nowhere and make no sense, and he's like weirdly sad about his assistant dying, not because you wouldn't be sad about your assistant dying, but the way he's sad is weird and it feels like it's leading to something. Like, I thought he was an alien. Like, I thought that was the revelation.
Me too.
Because he's acting like an alien, That never comes up. And then he's a businessman, and he's going to run for president in 2020. But he hates Trump, even though business people love Trump. And you quickly realize, oh, right, this is Doctor Who, and they are completely illiterate about American politics. And this makes no goddamn sense whatsoever. And then he, at the end of the episode, gets to deliver the single worst line I've ever heard on Doctor Who. You can correct me, Sean, if there is a worse one than this. But him firing the gun and going, how's this for fire and fury? That made me want to throttle someone. That is the worst line ever delivered on Doctor Who.
It's so fucking, like that line and almost every line that that dude has is so on the nose in the most just like, again, we talk about this feels like a rough draft or a like weird outline, like plot web thing. That's just like let's like do a character sketch on a fucking whiteboard and then forget to actually write the character. It's the just every fucking thing he says, everything he does is so ridiculous in an episode that is otherwise not ridiculous. And it's the thing with like Chris Noth that's like, you know, I can't speak much to his Sex and the City thing. I've seen like probably about 2/3 total of any Sex and the City episode in my life. And that's like aggregate time. I've seen some clips in some scenarios, one of which being in a college classroom. And I don't even remember what that scene was about, but there was some scene that a professor showed from Sex and the City. I don't even think he was in that scene, so I don't remember. But I like him okay from Law & Order Criminal Intent. Again, he was mostly there because Vincent D'Onofrio couldn't do 26 episodes and lead that show all the time. So they made another lead character they could do B episodes for. And so that's where he came up in that show from. But he was okay in that. But in this, it feels like I don't really feel like blaming Chris Noth because I feel like it's the writing in the direction because he feels like he's acting in a completely different television show.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't feel like that's really the actor's fault because somebody, if he doesn't know how people are supposed to act in Doctor Who because he's probably never seen an episode of Doctor Who before, I'm guessing, like, I wouldn't blame him. He's an American, like an older American guy. In what scenario would he have watched a bunch of Doctor Who before? The writer and, like, the showrunner and the director of the episode have got to, like, be like, this is kind of the tone we're going for. This, like, he's a little bit of a silly character, but he can't feel like a cartoon because Chris Noth feels like he's acting in an episode of Sarah Jane Adventures, not an episode of Doctor Who. It's such a ridiculous performance. It's so full of weird tics and random things. Like, the way he delivers a line is like he's delivering lines for six-year-olds, not for, like, a family show. It's really strange, And I am 100% with you. I was like 1/3 of the way through the episode. And it was around the time when he's washing his hands and like washing his hands the way an alien would, like to reference Vincent D'Onofrio again, like Vincent D'Onofrio in Men in Black, where he plays the alien wearing the dude's suit, like as skin as a suit, right? It's
water.
Like that. Yeah, water. And it's like jaws getting dislocated and shit. Great performance in that movie by Vincent D'Onofrio. But it feels like he's doing that. Until he's not doing that. And I swear to God, I should go back and look, like rewatch the scene. I swear there's a line he has after the spider comes up from the bathtub and he like does what is legitimately I thought was kind of funny is when he leaves his bodyguard in there, just closes the door behind him. I thought that was a decent gag before I like understood that this character is like weird and they're not going to really do anything with that. Because it's not that portrayal isn't even consistent throughout the episode. But he has a line where he says something like, They figured me out, or they found me, or something like that. That I was like, are you a spider in a human body? Like, what are you? Like, I really thought for a while that that's what he was supposed to be, until everybody else recognized him as a businessman, and then it slowly dawned on me that's like, oh, he's like a weird Trump analog, but they're also not pretending that Trump doesn't exist in this universe, so he's kind of not, because that doesn't work that well. It wasn't working well anyways, but like, I don't know what they're trying to do, and it's
they don't know what they're trying awkward. To do. The Trump stuff is so stupid because, I mean, in general, I don't like Doctor Who to reference current events and, like, date itself that way. I think that's a bad move. They did reference Trump, I think, twice obliquely last season. They were funny references, And it did also end with us seeing the president of the United States having killed himself. And that at least was a nice thought. That's a nice thought for us in America now of like, oh, maybe he could just off himself and we'd all be okay. And we wouldn't have to work so hard. But no, it's we at least, am I going to get a Secret Service check for that joke, Sean?
No, because it's you know, because that all took place inside of a computer simulation, John. Okay. So we're safe.
Okay. Anyway, but like, so that at least like they kind of did something with it, and it was just passing references. This is like, again, kind of as close as the episode gets to a theme of like spending all this time on like, he wants to challenge Trump, even though he's also clearly a conservative and a business person. So if you know anything about American politics, you know they are all completely simpatico with the racism and the, all that stuff. So they're fine with it. And none of those people would ever challenge him. So like, it's just, if you're an American, it's just fucking distracting. It is going to date the episode forever. It's just stupid. It's, I don't know. It just, it's kind of insulting, frankly, because you're just throwing around the name of like someone who carries real weight in the world in a very bad way, in the most frivolous, dumbass way you can. And then it leads to that horrible fire and fury line. And I just, fuck this episode. I said, you know what? I said these last two were better than, fuck that. No, this is a really bad episode of Doctor Who, Sean.
Yeah. I mean, and it's again, it's the same arc we've had with all these, where it's like, you know, the beginning couple of like the setup scenes in the first 15 minutes or whatever are fun and good. And I'd like, every time, every fucking time for the last four episodes, we've started up an episode, and I'm watching it like, I'm into this, and like, man, I love Graham, and man, Jodie Whittaker's really funny. And then as soon as the main plot starts rolling, it just slowly starts crumbling, and then like 10 minutes after the main plot kicks in, it's like the episode is like, you know, falling to pieces, weeping in a corner because it just doesn't even know what to do anymore. And it's just like, I don't know, we'll have Fire and Fury shoot the spider that's dying from its own body weight, even though really all the spiders should be dying from their own mass because they're all way too fucking gigantic. But that's fine. Whatever. At least they addressed it a little bit. And then we'll just lock all the other ones into the thing, and then it's like, oh, wait, but shit. Oh, this is the episode where by the end we have to have the companions specifically choose to stay with the doctor. Fuck, this episode's not about that at all. Well, we'll put the scene in there anyways, I guess. It's like, this is the only thing you can do.
It's so dumb. You know, next week is another Chris Chibnall episode. Maybe we'll just devote like 2 or 3 minutes to it. I don't know. If we don't have any more to say, I might cut it short. The week after that, we do get a start of a run of 4 episodes by new writers. We'll see. I'm more optimistic about those. But as I said to one of our listeners on Twitter today, you know, these don't get written in a vacuum. If Chris Chibnall is truly this inept at writing Doctor Who, and he seems very inept from these 4 episodes, which are somehow even worse than the like the ones he did under Moffat and RTD, which were fine. They weren't particularly good or bad. These are, like, bad. You know, the script still passed through him. He's still the guy telling these people how to write the episodes. Like, I don't know how much hope I have for the rest of this season. I hope it gets better. If it doesn't, I hope BBC realizes the need to protect this property and be proactive about getting it in someone else's hands, because this is near disastrous territory for Doctor Who, I think, creatively. I guess where I'm thinking now is maybe the line on Chris Chibnall's resume we all should have been focusing on was not Broadchurch, but maybe the 2 seasons of Torchwood he did that are really bad. Like, maybe that was the more relevant qualification here, or disqualification.
But at least those 2 seasons of Torchwood are bad in a way that's really trashy, and so you feel like, you know, you feel that, like, awful way that, like, you kind of love after watching that kind of show. That just feels like, it's like the television version of just eating a shit ton of Taco Bell or something. You're like, ugh, but I did it, but ugh. You know, it's 100% that. It's just sleazy and trashy and gross, but you kind of love it, and you hate that you love it. That's 100% what those 2 seasons of Torchwood are. And this doesn't have that at all.
No. No. It's, I don't know. Maybe Big Finish will save Jodie Whittaker in about 20 years. All right. With that sad thought, we'll be back next week. We'll be talking about Red Dead Redemption 2 in a lot more detail. I doubt either of us will have finished the game. So,
I have a solid 0% chance that I will finish this game within the next week.
So, you know, we will just continue to talk about it. Maybe there will be a Doctor Who worth talking about. But I mean, seriously, like, if we have no more than what we said this week, I will probably cut that one short because I don't want to be repetitive. And we'll see what happens after that. It's a busy time. I want to go play some more Red Dead Redemption. I got to go buy clothes now that I've learned that you can do that in this game. I probably should have figured that out, but I was too busy robbing the clerk. So, yeah, that's my next move, Sean.
Yeah. Go buy clothes, Jonathan. Go buy those clothes and dress up that cowboy man.